This podcast is sponsored by Audible. Start listening with a 30-day Audible trial, and your first audiobook plus two Audible originals are free. Visit audible.com/GOT or text GOT to 500-500 to begin.
This podcast is sponsored by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again. Get $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons package and 1 year of Eero Plus. Visit Eero.com/GOT and at checkout, enter promo code GOT. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
It's the only podcast that the Double D's do not want you to hear. We're talking about Season 8, Episode 5, titled The Bells, today. Aaron, I've seen this episode more times than I care to count at this point. After seeing it numerous times, what's your opinion?
I mean, so I'm not as angry as I was. I think I'm allowed to have an emotional reaction.
That's the instant take.
And if you recall, like when I talked about the first time I came across a red wedding in the books, even though I was kind of semi-spoiled, that's the reason I started reading the books, is because I got some jackass on Reddit spoiled me for the red wedding. I didn't know the full details. When I got to that point in the book, I had to put the book down for like 2 weeks because I was so fucking pissed and outraged by it, and that I felt like everything tracked in retrospect, but that was just my emotional reaction. I'm a fan. I love the show. I love the characters. And when one of the heroes turns into a supervillain, I think I'm allowed to have an emotional reaction to that just purely off the bat. But I also think that they didn't tell the story particularly well. I think that the stuff with Jaime is still beyond perplexing to me. And then you mix in a healthy dose of Euron and some dodgy, just mechanics and tactics and stuff like that. I'm still disappointed. I'm not like fired up and angry.
Although we may get there by the end of this episode.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I'm gonna stir some shit up, I'll say.
I'm going to try to be funnier and not as angry. But here's the thing. Like, I think a lot of people also came at us kind of crazy. I would say that our mailbag was roughly split in 33 percentiles of people that love this episode and don't see any problems with it and think that everyone that does is a bunch of, mumpty heads. I think there's about a solid third of people that are like, yeah, I mean, it's fine where they're going to Dany, but I don't think they quite got there. I can see both sides. And then there's some people that just hate everything about it. If you're going to argue with us, I'm going to speak for myself, and you can agree or disagree, Jim, but like, at least argue with the point that I'm actually making. Yes, I did not see Dany turning to the dark, so I didn't think that they would actually go through with that. It's not like my first choice of how this Game of Thrones should be resolved. But I'm open to, like, I am open to the fact that this has been foreshadowed. Like, they've done a good job of making it to where, in hindsight, Dany's turn to the dark side is kind of inevitable. But I do think they were missing a piece or two. And I also think that the people that are saying that was completely perfectly foreshadowed are giving a lot of credence to the stuff that they kind of shoehorned in this season. Like, they're taking a lot of the things that she said and a lot of statements she made, and the other thing is, like, I also just didn't buy Dany and John's relationship falling apart.
The trouble is, and my girlfriend said this while we were watching it for the first time, or at least her for the first time yesterday, she never bought Dany and John.
Right.
Like, they never sold the love story.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't sell the breakup story.
Right. Right.
The true betrayal there.
Yeah. So,
and I agree with her.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm not saying that I don't like this, because I don't think that Dany's turn to the dark side is valid. I think that's, very George Martin thing to do. It's just, I don't think they told the job particularly well, and they made a whole lot of unforced errors along the way. So, like, and here's the thing. I think even the people that just love this episode unreservedly have to admit that turning one of the top two heroes in the game into a villain is something that you have to really sit up straight and dot all your I's and cross all your T's to have the fan base to kind of just go along with it. And have it feel like it's set, you know, not satisfying, but inevitable in the same way that the Red Wedding is. Mm. And when we get to this point in the episode, I kind of want to compare and contrast the Red Wedding to this thing with Danny. Maybe people agree with me, maybe people won't. But I don't know. I just hope to be a little bit less obnoxious discussing it, I guess, because I'm trying to persuade people, you know?
Yeah, I think necessarily we will be. Simply because we have more time. Like time has tempered my anger. Time has not tempered my opinion,
right,
or my disappointment.
And the other thing is, like, a lot of people's evidence that they cited to show that Danny is got this Mad King, Mad Queen stuff in her is things that, like, I just fundamentally disagree with the analysis and the context. Like, she locked Zaran Zon Duck Sauce in a vault. Well, yeah, but he did her real dirty. And like, this story is full of heroes like beheading people that betray him. Like, this is a medieval, like, that's
I mean, it
rough
starts
justice,
off with
but
Ned
it's
delivering
justice,
right?
Danny lied to and burnt all the slave masters in Astapor, but they're fucking slave. I mean, they were SOC and Nazis. Uh-huh. Like, you can kill an unlimited amount of them and no one feels sorry for them. Season 4, Danny executes hundreds of Myrinese noblemen, some of whom later turned out to be innocent. I mean, there's lots of studies that suggest between 2 and 4% of the people on death row are completely innocent. And yet, every governor that I'm aware of in the Union still supports capital punishment. I would be shocked to learn that the governor of Colorado razed a city to the ground full of innocent people. Like, the thing is like, she's never crossed a line of killing innocent people, and to do so on the crux of getting everything that she wants, just, that's not the straw that broke the dragon's back to me.
Yeah.
That's not, they didn't do a good job of portraying Danny as crazy. I think there's some people that, The closest that people come to the mark is trying to paint her as someone that's just very traumatized, and that she. But
I think there's a lot of credence to lend to the idea that she is power obsessed in
right.
some ways. I think
right.
like her main focus, while it is also freeing slaves and breaking the wheel and like all of the things that she says about, you know, breaker of chains. That many of her titles are positive, but the other thing she is power hungry. She
right.
believes that this is her destiny, her right. And I agree with that. I simply don't think they told the story well enough.
Yeah. And I think that also you've got a little bit of a problem that the show tends to want to hop on like modern sensibilities and then medieval sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I feel like is happening in this last season or two of Justification is we are going to just suddenly apply modern day sensibilities to like Danny's actions to paint them to be evil when, you mm-hmm. know,
like with the Tarleys.
Yeah, like executing like people by dragon without any kind of due process or this is shocking. But honestly, you also have the leader of an army and you offer them a chance to surrender and they don't take it and then they're executed.
I think there are other solutions there that are less violent, that
sure.
are potentially more diplomatically appropriate.
Right. But Rob
so, beheaded- so I think she is a little. You know,
right?
Wrong in that case.
But Rob beheaded the Karstarks. He wasn't portrayed as crazy.
Sure.
Like John beheaded Janos Slynt. He wasn't portrayed as crazy. John hung all of the Black Brothers, who, you know, we talked about in the episode. Like when he did that, he hung all the mutineers. It's not that the mutineers didn't have a point.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that like that's you went against the king and you missed, and you like once you commit that level of treason, you're dead. Like. But now it's like suddenly we want to say that Danny's like, oh, well, this is just because Tyrion said it, just because Varys said it, like that this is, I mean, there's a whole lot of like them telling us that Danny was doing this and we should feel a certain way. And I guess I just never was buying it.
No. And I mean, that's the problem, the fundamental problem with John and Danny's relationship and how this betrayal can't really be such because I never felt the connection. They never showed me that John and Danny loved each other. If banging on a boat
mm-hmm.
equals love, then the dude who put on the fire festival loves a lot of Instagram models. Like, what?
Well,
that
fair,
is not love, right? That is
yeah.
that is something that could be entirely separate from love. They never showed me those key things.
Also,
and
Jamie
so
banged,
when this betrayal happens,
Jamie banged Brienne, so I guess they're true blue and love.
They love each other, yeah. What an asshole. That's the thing. They never set those pieces up quite right for me to believe this.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in retrospect, I think that makes some of those episodes worse, especially last episode, because, you know, we were talking about Jamie and how, you know, we absolutely do not believe that he's returning to Cersei. Everything in his arc has been pointing toward redemption. Everything has been pointing toward him going back to deal with this problem, which is Cersei. So,
and they subverted the expectations, but in the process, they turned his arc into a circle.
That does not make sense either, because the other half of Jaime is very much for the innocents. And,
yes. And that's the thing.
And there's
yes.
a line in this episode that yes. has no business being in there, which we'll talk about in context of the
scene.
We're
in danger of spoiling our own podcast.
but that's the problem is that they fundamentally, and this is why in the instant take, and I still believe this firmly, and I think it bears out in the reviews of this episode, this is the worst Game of Thrones episode, in my opinion, because it undercuts characters so viciously. And we've never had this opportunity for an episode to let us down so badly.
And we
now have 8 years of history with these characters, and to undercut all of that history to simply do something shocking is completely dissatisfying in the worst way possible.
Yeah, and like that's your subjective opinion, true.
Yeah.
But if you look at Rotten Tomatoes,
it has a 49%. It is literally the worst rated episode of Game of Thrones ever.
By a pretty good margin. And you know, some of that's
last episode was with like 53. Mm-hmm. But those two are very far down the list. Yeah.
And like I said, you know, I think the opinions are going to moderate somewhat, like depending on how the next episode goes. Like I think, because the other thing is, I think the first half of this episode really worked for me. And I think the second half, if you buy that Dany just fucking went crazy, works actually very beautifully. None of the stuff with Jaime and Cersei quite worked for me. I got a little bit of problems with the stuff with Arya. But like that's the thing is like the two halves, I don't think connected. You needed one more thing, and then, like, I'm all on board. And again, you can disagree with us, but, like, there is... I who knows? The coin flip is still, I guess, in the air about where the fandom's going to come down, like, a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, 10 years from now. But it feels like the preponderance of fans, they didn't do enough to tell the story, and people are mad about it. And they're not mad in the same way they were mad about the Red Wedding,
the Red Wedding makes perfect sense.
About Ned being beheaded, about Oberyn getting his head smashed in. They're not upset in that way. They're upset because, unlike all those events, this didn't feel inevitable.
No, this felt like, very shortcutted.
Yeah.
It felt like they simply wanted to be done with this.
And that's different from saying that it wasn't because like foreshadowing and character development are different. You know,
I agree.
Two different distinct things. So we'll try to keep that in mind as
we've said a lot of bad about this episode so far. Let me say some good.
Yes.
Because there is a lot to like about this episode.
Yes.
Outside of the characters in general. I think the acting is amazing. Even characters like Jamie, who I think are fundamentally undercut in this episode, do an incredible job portraying the emotions that they want them to portray.
And I'll say that, like, I think, I mean, I don't know, because I'm guessing people's motivations, which is dangerous, but at least I'm going to try. I think that a lot of people saying that this worked for them are saying that, like, all of the just amazing filmmaking and all levels.
Yeah.
Did enough to win him over, because it damn near does it for me. Like, I don't think that Jaime and Cersei went out in a way that I think honors their character arcs, but their last scene is pretty fucking just standalone beautiful. I don't think that, like, Dany's fault...
Beautiful, but so heartless, because...
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to me.
I don't think that Sacky King's Landing necessarily followed, but it was executed gorgeously, and there's a lot of really powerful points about what war does to people. And also, now that I've seen it a couple times, there ain't nothing wrong with this Clegane Bowl.
No.
This is the Clegane... This Clegane Bowl is as good as any we could possibly hope for.
And this is...
It's flawless. It's the flawless part
satisfying.
Of the episode.
It's the most satisfying thing in the episode, simply because everything about the character led here.
Everything tracks.
Yeah.
And it's what we... And it's I mean, it's not necessarily what I think people wanted, because like what I wanted was the Hound to win and then finally find peace, or like to be left in a point where he kind of wonders now what. Like, kind of like, I guess, you know, Inigo Montoya from Princess Bride is like, I've been in the Vengeance game, now I don't know what happened. Maybe someone can suggest piracy. Maybe he can be the new lord of the Iron Islands. But, like, it wasn't necessarily the ending or how I thought the Clegane Bowl would go. But holy shit, there's nothing. I can't argue with a thing about how they executed it.
Yeah, I mean, the cool thing about it is maybe it's not the ending for the Hound that you wanted, but I think it's the ending that the Hound wanted.
Yeah.
For the Hound. Like,
yeah. And Rory McCann.
I think the two very things that he wants most in his life are to kill the Mountain and to die.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't see himself having a place in the world after that.
And
mission.
A goal that he discovered along the way, which is saving Arya.
Yeah, he accomplishes
sure
the scene before.
That, but that was a great beat for his character, for sure.
I thought so. Yeah. Those moments are excellent. I think there's some excellent stuff between Tyrion and Varys, Tyrion and Jaime.
Yep.
All of those moments hit really well emotionally.
I thought actually Emilia Clarke, who I've been critical sometimes with these very strong emotions, did her damnedest to sell a person just having a psychotic break over nothing. Especially when you think of that she did this performance in a giant green box with no other actor with her riding a green mechanical bull.
Yeah.
That,
it's impressive. The acting is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
The music. I mean, you know, how can you take anything away from Ramin?
Sure.
He's incredible. He's done some of the best work in I wanted to say television scores, but I'm going to say scores, period, since John Williams. Like, he is redefining a generation of music on film.
Yeah.
And this episode is no exception. I think every single person on this effects team deserves an award.
Yeah, and unlike in the Battle of Winterfell, there was no dense fog and
there was
smoke,
but it worked.
It was lit, and like the nighttime execution scene of Varys was lit beautifully and amazingly, and like I just felt like the use of light and dark was so much better in this episode because they didn't have to shroud everything with fog. Like when it was shrouded to fog, it was for a particular purpose and it lasted just long enough for that to accomplish that purpose. It's tough because the whole reason that was happening about Winterfell is so this Night King could deny the aerial superiority, which would have toasted him.
Right.
Because if nothing else, this episode shows just how unstoppable these dragons are when they're allowed to just uncork.
Yeah. And then the final thing I want to give it up for is the makeup department. I can't tell you how amazing Arya's face by the end of this thing looks.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people are making a big deal about the pale horse and the rider death. And like the envisioning of that particular idea is just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
The attention to detail, like the way that the blood streaks across her face sideways because she was laying on her side, and how the dust covers the rest of it. And she almost looks, I mean, she does look otherworldly. This whole landscape looks otherworldly, and she matches, and it's amazing.
Yeah. All of the battle sequences were done so well. So much, like, I've seen so many fucking battles. I've seen so many medieval battles, but this one managed to show me a couple things I had never seen before.
Dude, the gore, when it first starts up, I've never seen a more gruesome depiction of a sword battle.
Yeah.
And it made perfect sense. Like, when somebody puts a sword through you, it's, you know, it's not going to stop at your neck.
Right.
It might actually go a foot into you and take out half your body. Like, that's just the force of these things. And
that's butchery. That's butchery.
Yeah. It's amazing. Amazing from a visual effects.
I wish I was on the same page as everyone, because like, I get it. If you can get over the hurdle, if you buy Dany's fall, then this, I can see why this is like a
best episode.
10-10 episode. Although I do think that even if you buy that, there's other problems, and some of it are just like,
oh yeah, but if you can get over all those
throughout this whole season and going back to last season,
yeah, and retroactively, I think it makes those things more glaring. But there's a lot to like about this episode. However, I think it's marred entirely by some really just selling short in the writing.
Sure.
We've talked for a very long time. Should we get into the recap?
We should. Yes. Okay, before we get into the episode proper, we've got a little bit of housekeeping to do. Tomorrow on the Bald Move TV feed, we're doing a standalone review of the second episode of Chernobyl, which, if you thought this episode was a disaster, let me tell you, it's got nothing on a nuclear reactor cooking off. So check out the Bald Move TV feed. You can find that on any podcast app by just searching Bald Move TV. I declare hashtag fan bankruptcy still in the merch store, merch.baldmove.com. And it's not too late. I hear not too late to declare bankruptcy and save the season for the last episode. Wednesday, we're deploying our penultimate Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy Edition as we discuss the movie Excalibur. There's an enhanced podcast at youtube.com/baldmove. There is a live watch for club members. And if you subscribe to the movies feed, the Bald Movies feed, you can get the podcast. And you'll want to do that because we're also going to be reviewing John Wick 3 next week as well. Parabellum, the final chapter in the John Wick saga. Tomorrow on twitch.tv/baldmove, Cecily and I are going to be co-oping, if you can call it that, some Mario World 3D. And next Tuesday, something fun for Game of Thrones fans, Jim and I, immediately after recording the final Game of Thrones podcast, are going to be getting on Twitch to play some of this browser. What's the name of that game? It's a browser-based Game of Thrones game.
Winter is coming.
Winter is coming. We're going to mess around with that for a couple hours. And then we'll also be debuting we did this a long time ago, but it was a club mem feature. This is going to be available for everybody. We played through all of the Telltale Game of Thrones and had a hell of a lot of fun doing it.
We play as bad guy Forrester, which is a lot of fun.
We really try to run House Forrester into the ground and pretty much managed to do so. Godsofthrones.com, we're having a... not sure how we feel about this episode sale. Both volumes are 25% off. You can go to godsofthrones.com to get the links for those. Also, don't forget, we got a free preview chapter that you can peruse at your leisure. Pin-y.com. We're out of this house snow pins, but we still have Starewood, the brand's face on a weirwood pin. It's very cool, very enamel, very penny at pin-y.com. And finally, Friday for Bald Move TV, we've got just a bevy of new shows that we're going to be covering. So again, you'll want to check that out. That's it at baldmove.com.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. the thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Okay, well, we start off with Varys writing a letter detailing Jon's claim to the throne. One of his spies walks in and tells him that the soldiers are watching her, and she's very nervous, and there's an interesting thread here in this scene where, if you didn't notice, it seems like Varys is trying to poison Dany.
Yeah, I thought that, like, when I first watched this episode, I thought, like, I'm not sure if they gave Varys due justice. And Varys is in a very desperate position, but yeah. Now I've seen it a couple times. It seems obvious that, like, Varys was pulling every fucking stop he could. He had found a network of little birds. He was actively trying to poison her.
Let's lay out the case. You know, yeah. This girl walks in and she's, she's being watched by the guards. Varys says, you know, with great risk comes great reward.
Right. She's not.
What would that have to do with feeding the queen?
Right. Did it work? No, she's not eating anything.
Right. We'll try again at supper.
Exactly.
A lot of veiling of the true intention here, which I think is Varys' way, and it makes perfect sense. In hindsight. So I like this scene, and I like what they did with Varys a lot more after second and third and maybe fourth viewings.
Yeah.
So then Varys goes down to the beach and he tells Jon that Dany will make a bad queen and Jon is actually the better choice. He practically begs him to step up and be the king that the realm needs, and Jon refuses.
Yeah, and I thought, like, in first, like, is Varys pushing too hard? But, like, now that I properly understand that first scene, I think that this is just Varys in full desperation. Like, he tries the riddle of power with Jon. It just doesn't work. Like, he is in a situation where I think, and, you know, the episode proves him correct, he sees these very worrisome and dangerous trends for Dany, but because there's also just as much evidence that she's the co-savior of mankind, people, you know, like, especially Jon, just isn't going to want to see it. Like, Jon is not the guy who is going to soberly evaluate his claim to the throne against his rival lover aunt's claim, and also her strange, but, like, again, all this stuff was understandable. Like, nobody, like, it's something that maybe is worrisome, but you could always, like, well, it's this and that. Like, it was not like, wow, Dany killed a lot of innocent people for no justification. We should have seen her killing tens of thousands of people.
And I think this scene is even better than I first gave it credit for. After watching it a few times, I realized when he says this line, this riddle to Jon about flipping a coin, he's talking to a Targaryen.
Mm-hmm.
He's openly out there telling Jon, I know your secret.
Yeah.
Jon doesn't think that he could know his secret. He's tickling the dragon's tail here.
Yeah.
Literally? I think literally he's tickling the dragon's tail. It's just so much more delicious when you think, oh, Jon is Targaryen. He's talking about the madness of the Targaryens.
Right.
He knows where Jon's coin has landed, which is another tip-off. Not sure about Daenerys. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But seeing all of this happen, Tyrion goes to Dany, who's looking pretty bad, having not eaten in a long time.
Are you familiar with Jenny Nicholson's work?
Uh-huh.
She does. Yeah. Did you see she posted like a 6-minute video in the style of like a YouTube apology video where she was Daenerys? And so I want to talk about all the stuff that's been going on. And it's really, she's made up just like a woman on YouTube that's fucked up. And is trying to apologize, is losing millions of fans a day, and she's trying to apologize for it.
Nice.
Everybody check Jenny Nicholson's channel out. She's great.
So Tyrion tells her that Varys has betrayed her, which she didn't actually know, but she deduces, you know, how that happened. And Dany's really pissed that Tyrion's been spreading that secret.
And this is
that
great.
Could destroy her claim.
She's got Tyrion dead to rights. Like, you know, she trusted. Yeah, she trusted you to do her dirty work for her.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, Sansa was trying to do dirty work. You know, we that's one of the things we've been lamenting, not in a bad way, but like Sansa's trying to play this game, and it's feeding all of Dany's worst intentions and her worst proclivities and her worst fears. And it's unfortunate, but like all this stuff so far working really well for me.
Yeah, I will say I'm a little disappointed retroactively in what they've done with Tyrion. Now that Varys is gone,
yes,
I don't think there's opportunity. And now that Dany has blown up King's Landing, there's no opportunity here for Tyrion to be
distinguish himself. Yeah,
to be Tyrion, the Tyrion that we loved from seasons ago.
Because he didn't even really engineer the bell ring.
No, I mean Tyrion has done nothing but fuck up in the last three seasons.
Yeah.
And like I was thinking back to it, he really hasn't done anything exciting or powerful or interesting since. He tried to negotiate a truce between the masters.
He let the dragons out of the dungeon.
Okay.
And tried to negotiate a truce with the masters,
yeah,
which just made him look like a fucking idiot in front of Dany, because Dany came back and quit, you know.
Yeah, but I think
put an end to all that.
But I think he was very smart in what he was trying
sure.
to do. He understood the scenario, and that's what I always loved about Tyrion.
He didn't have dragon mastery. Like he was doing the best he could to save her kingdom, and so, but from that point on, which that's late season five, early season
yes.
six.
Yes,
he hasn't had a win, not a single win, and all of his losses are bound up with like what looks like apparent loyalty to the Lannisters, which. After this episode, I gotta feel like that Tyrion's more on Team Lannister than he is Team Dany.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that concept because Varys is so for the realm that I almost wonder if a little bit of that didn't rub off on Tyrion, and that Tyrion is yes letting Cersei escape, but also more importantly doing it for the people in King's Landing.
Right.
It's kind of a coin toss for me, and I'm not sure where it comes down on.
Yeah.
So Varys is taken to the beach and he's burned alive with dragon fire.
Can we talk about his rest?
Okay.
Because I really like the detail of him taking off his jewels, but I don't know why. Yeah.
So I think this is to tell the audience that he knows.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, like when in Ocean's 11, when Dany Ocean gets like arrested, if he starts like taking off his shoes and like, or it's like, is like, there's something here. It's like
he puts his hand behind his head, right?
Yeah, like very. Yeah, he's like I'm. Yeah, it's like or in the Fifth Element when Bruce Will, like the cops are sweeping a building and he just gets against it and puts his hands on the circles.
Right.
Like there's something like Varys is an insider and like this isn't like when the old maester whose name is slipping my name. Well, who's the old Pycelle?
Pycelle, yeah.
Like when Pycelle got and he says, "Oh, this was like Varys knows the score. He's taking it." I'm not sure why he's doing any of this, but it feels like a guy who knows the score and knows the routine and knows what's going to happen to him, and he's just preparing himself now.
It's a nice touch.
Before we move on to his trial and conviction and execution, can we talk about what is the damage that he's done here? Because for the life of me, I don't know who he's sending these obvious Raven messages to.
I don't think we're supposed to, yeah.
Like,
I think that will be revealed next episode.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, because it just doesn't seem like there's enough functional Westeros left to, you know, like, people are either going to back John or I don't know. I'm just wondering. I know he was sending ravens. Obviously, they were saying that, you know, John is the true. He's actually Aegon Targaryen and he's the true heir and he's got a better claim, which, you know, but it does seem like there's already enough. This episode provides enough evidence that like John and Davos and Tyrion have to join up and take Dany down.
100%. Yeah.
Like, so.
Yeah, there's no alternative.
All right. So maybe Varys just dies just to give, you know, just to give Tyrion a little bit of conviction and backbone.
I mean, I think he's definitely sending letters. I just don't, like, he could send him to the Vale, he could send him to Dorne, he could send him to Yara, maybe. Like,
yeah.
There's not, you're right, there's not a lot of Westeros
like
left.
I think we're supposed to understand, like, the poison scheme, it's not going to work, but maybe it will give some people, a little bit of a stiff spine that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah.
Because look at Varys, he risked all to try to, you know, and he was ultimately right. And the way they played this about him, like, I sincerely hope I'm wrong, I totally bought that from Varys.
Yeah, that moment between him and Tyrion is...
Like, this is a guy who's going to death, and he doesn't beg, and he doesn't plead. He's not like a Littlefinger, because all he does... What happens to him is not as important as what happens to the realm. And I have, for so long... Because book Varys, I think, is a different beast. He might be a little bit more tricksy, but show Varys, I think, has been True Blue the whole time. Like, I came from nothing. I'm looking after the little guy the way I wish someone had looked out after me. Mm-hmm. And he died the way he lived, and I thought that's a great end for his character. I also, like, this scene, again, fucking beautiful. The way mm-hmm. it was shot, the way it was lit, the way Drogon slowly emerges from the inky blackness, the fire glinting in his eyes.
The moment they give it between Dracarys and actually burning.
But here's the point. Like, Jon side-eyes Dany.
Uh-huh.
But tell me how this execution is any different than Ned killing the deserter in season one.
It is no
different. Like, how do you not... kill
this is exactly
Varys.
What John would have done in the situation.
Yeah, the fact, like, is he squeamish because she fed him to a dragon? Because, like, I promise you, Varys's death is no more.
Maybe because she didn't swing the sword. Like,
but I think that's the point. Is like, I don't think you can honestly argue that, because her saying Dracarys is her swinging the sword. Like, sure. Drogon doesn't burn that guy unless she commands it. So,
yeah, but if Ned had said, "Chop this man's head off." It'd be a little different than him picking up the sword and doing it himself. But I take your point. Like
that's her weapon. She doesn't have a sword.
Right. But that's kind of my cheeky way of saying this is exactly what Ned would have done, what Ned did do.
Yes.
This is exactly what John, as an adherent of Ned's philosophy, would have done. So, he would have put this man to death.
So to me, just John side-eyeing Dany in this circumstance feels false.
I agree.
Okay.
Much more so, I think, than the Tarleys, because they're enemy combatants. They could...
Sure.
Like, and I know John's not there in that moment, but the people side-eyeing her in that moment...
Because that's...
kind of have a point. Like, just take these people prisoner, right?
Yeah. And by Westerosi custom, that's what you should do to a person that won't, like, because you can ransom them, you can use them
they're
to...
they're valuable.
Yeah, there's many other ways. Like, burning them is just, you know... I mean... But you can also say that, like, that's a way, like, that's an Aegon Targaryen move. Like, you either kneel or you die, you know? And this actually, you know, it's kind of like the same atomic bomb logic. Like, well, you drop bombs on cities so that you save, you kill hundreds of thousands to save millions. And I just, like, again, I just, John Sidenine, I mean, it just did not make sense to me.
Yeah. All right, move on to Grey Worm burning Missandei's only possession, which is her former slave collar. John comes in and he visits Dany, who rakes him over the coals for telling Sansa his secret. She's very sad that she's not loved by anyone in Westeros. And John says, "Well, that's not true. I love you and you're my queen." But when she goes to kiss him, he completely withdraws from her. And she takes the hint and decides that if she can't rule with love, she's going to rule with fear.
I wish, first of all, Grey Worm burning Missandei's collar is amazing. Like, her only possession is the slave collar she owned, and this, like, underscores the whole Dracarys thing. Like, I really like that. I also really like Dany's here's the thing, though. I don't understand why this is happening. Like, Varys had an opinion that John might not be comfortable boning his aunt because he's from the north, and that's the only thing that has served as an explanation for why John would sour on Dany. And I don't know, like, this is a man who has already broken vows that he saw as extremely important. This is a person who's discovered the fact that he's a Targaryen. The fact that, like, you're just supposed to intuit that he can't have a romantic relationship with Dany because she's his aunt, who he doesn't think... I just don't make sense to me in this particular world.
I'm not sure how I feel about that one.
I mean, like, I could see, like, you know, from a modern standpoint, like, you find out it's, you know, this is your aunt,
sure,
and but, like, you know, they're... I think you're right, they both lightly told the story of them falling in love. Like, them falling in love is essentially, we're both young, attractive, and idealistic, and we also are on each other's level, and we've never really met anybody like that before.
Do you remember how well they told it with Ygritte and Jon?
Sure. Yeah,
it
they
was,
took
it
a
was
whole
so
season,
much more fleshed out.
A whole
out.
Season to go from adversary to lovers. And also, Ygritte kind of had, like, the whole, like... in her, the back of her mind, she kind of saw John slipping away, but she didn't want to believe it. She was blind to that by love. And that actually is like a season and a half. This thing, it's like they met, they had boat sex,
yeah,
and then they found out they were related. And, like, this is like a 5-episode arc, and it's just it's a little fast, and it also sticks in my craw that the double D's were offered by HBO. It's one thing to turn, like, I don't want to do multiple seasons, but HBO says, "Hey, we'll write a check for 10 episodes," and they say, "We don't need it," and then we get this.
Yeah.
You needed it.
You needed
I think you needed it.
You absolutely
and the fact
needed
that
it.
This is hitting 50% on Rotten Tomatoes says at least 50% of fandom says you need a little bit more time.
Yeah.
So
I agree. Keep this whole scene in mind because
if they had have told, like, just before we move it, if they had told the story well, the all right then let it be fear, Emilia Clarke fucking nailed that, like, dangerously spurned lover.
I would buy it, certainly. But yeah, keep all of this in mind because we're going to talk later in context with Danny burning the city and in context of Thrones Revealed, which is kind of the after show.
Right.
Interview with the Double D's. There's a lot in there that I want to delve into that's sort of meta, but sort of like reveals what they were thinking in these scenes.
Because we don't get to...
And it's very important.
That's the other thing, is we don't get to... We don't have to see this just in vacuum. Like, we have the creators themselves saying what their thought processes were, and we can also evaluate things based on that.
Yeah, so many fans I see are saying, okay, this is the moment. This is the moment where she decides she's going to burn everyone.
Right.
And that when she says, okay, let it be fear... That means everyone in King's Landing is dead. And I disagree.
I
have a lot of supporting evidence.
Yes.
And I'll lay it out when we get there.
Right. We're about to get to the first piece of evidence, I think.
Okay. So Tyrion argues his point about sparing the people of King's Landing with Dany. Dany seems to agree to call off the attack if Tyrion can get the people to ring the bells and surrender. She nods to Grey Worm. In my mind, indicating acknowledgement that this is the new plan.
I noticed that there's a lot of people that took the great exception to our review said that this, like, a lot of people said that this, you're supposed to understand that nod was her to be like, whatever this guy's saying, you and I understand each other, right, Grey Worm? I don't think that's in the text.
It is not.
The way I see it is that she won this last argument.
Because there's
with Tyrion.
A very long, lingering look at Tyrion as she's trying to decide, will I give him one last chance?
Right.
And she says, I've given you one last chance.
Yep.
And if you fuck me again, I'm going to kill you.
And she nods to Grey Worm.
She nods to Grey Worm. Yes, go with Tyrion's plan.
Yeah.
So. In my mind,
this isn't Lando,
not premeditated.
This isn't Lando nodding to Lobot like, hey, we're going to take the stormtroopers. This is like, he's one. I'm not that type of person. I don't want to be that person. Let's do it.
Right.
Because they had a long argument where she's like, you know, well, the slaves I freed fought for themselves. And he's like, yeah, but that's not the relationship these people had with Cersei. Like, they're hostages. And she's like, well, yeah, they're hostages of Tyrion. How's that my fault? And, you know, the weakness of mercy. And, like, there was a nice back and forth. And I think Tyrion won.
Yeah, it felt like he did convince her to try one more desperate move. And
so
if it doesn't work, keep going.
And if you think that there is some private agreement between Grey Worm and Dany, I don't see how that's in the text at all. That's an inference.
They never reveal it.
That's a surmisal.
Not set it up, but they also don't reveal it.
Right.
So
right.
How are we to guess at any of that?
Right. Yeah.
I took from that scene that she said, yes, try this.
Agreed.
Okay. People continue to stream. Oh, actually, at the end of that scene, she also tells Tyrion that Jaime was captured trying to get through their lines.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a moment.
Go ahead. Because I do have. So here's one of the problems that I'm going to let Gary S. explain. So when Jaime first turns up at Winterfell in front of Dany, she wants to kill him for stabbing her father in the back, and only the intervention of Brienne, who's vouched for via Sansa, who Dany, by the way, now hates, prevents her from executing him. So at this point, she captures Jaime for betraying her for trying to get back to Cersei, but she just decides to keep him as a prisoner. Yet Varys gets the full-on Dracarys treatment in the same time for betraying her. This is kind of a problem. What
it is? Yeah.
Can someone explain to me why Dany would have Jaime held prisoner on the eve of this battle and not just make it a 2-for-1?
It's because how would Tyrion and Jaime get a final moment together to say goodbye?
In fact,
if he got Dracarys up,
that's what I'm saying. Like, in fact, she's keeping him prisoner for like two because there's a day and a night transition that comes. So she's keeping him prisoner for multiple days. And you're right; the only explanation is because they needed this next thing for Tyrion to happen.
Yeah, that's
so. It's again like if that's okay with you, that's fine, but. Please recognize that this is an instance where the writers are just pulling a fast one and hoping that you go along with it.
And so much of this story, the shock value that has come in Game of Thrones, has been mined from the inevitable logical conclusion of characters' actions.
Yes.
And this...
The inevitability.
This is the complete opposite.
Yes.
The inevitable thing that would happen here is Jamie would be instantly killed by Danny.
Right.
Not that he would be preserved, tied to yet another fucking tent pole.
Right.
And yet another fucking enemy encampment. Like... They've done this so many times now.
Right.
And I get, like, that's probably why they wanted to circle back. You know, yeah. Do this callback to how many times has Jaime been in this situation. Do the callback to when he freed Tyrion. Do all these things.
Because sure. That stuff that's works
great,
real well.
But you undermine other characters in the process. And yes. You need to find a way to do both.
Yeah.
And that's what they did so well in previous seasons.
Sure. Right. Because they had, like, really careful plotting and source material and all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so people continue to stream into the Red Keep. I was wrong, by the way. This is going to be a very long episode. I said in the instant take, it'd probably be short. Nope.
There's no... I mean, it's the penultimate episode. If you want, like, a 30-minute episode podcast, then, you know, I don't know
I didn't think the opinions would be this divisive, and we'd have to, like...
Yeah.
Start that we have going to really, into the minutia
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, we have to really build our case here, I feel like.
Yeah. So people stream into the Red Keep. Tyrion and Jon and quite a few of the troops land on the beaches outside King's Landing. They plan to attack at daybreak, and Tyrion asks Davo a mysterious favor, which we'll find out.
Is it kind of crazy that Davos just, like, this is all off screen, that he just grants, like, yeah, I'll do this?
Yeah, I think it works, though. I don't know what Tyrion told him. I want to assume that Tyrion didn't tell him exactly what was up, just sort of like, leave
to,
a boat.
I need you to leave here. A boat down here for somebody, like...
Yeah, the Onion Knight thought, oh, we're getting a shipment.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I just thought that, like... I mean, if this was the worst thing that happened in the episode, I'd be okay. But, like,
definitely.
This is a dangling Chad, to say the least.
A little bit. I'll give you that.
Okay.
I think the more egregious thing is, like, there is no fleet on this side of King's Landing. How did they land so many troops on this beach?
Dude, and, like...
Under the nose of Euron.
Under the walls that looks like... I mean, again, this goes back
surely
to the sins
people,
of last episode.
The people with the ballistas, the people with the scorpions, yes. Can see the encampment being built painstakingly yes. Over the course of what must be days.
And again...
And they could probably, like... I don't know, send somebody down to say, hey, Euron, can you go blast any ship that comes in here? Send one ship over there to deal with these fucks.
Yeah, because Danny doesn't have any, so they can just...
Why are you allowing enemy troops to land on your beaches?
I don't know. And also, like, I think they did a poor job of staging this because this is the sins of last episode. They're well within those ballista ranges.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, the range of those things, as seen of last episode, is fucking obscene.
And they have the Navy, like...
The realistic range of this is already enough to realistically threaten a dragon, but the dragon, like, there's a tension there. Like, if this thing had a realistic range of 300-400 yards, like...
A dragon would never be...
Like, you only get one shot
danger.
At it, right?
Yeah, swooping down
like,
to kill
like,
you.
By the time you're in fire range, the dragon's in ballista, but, like, no, this thing's out of range of, like, 3 nautical miles. So, like, they're Iowa-class battleships just fucking... there's no reason why they should be allowed to just set up this camp.
I mean, you've got
close.
You've got a navy. Mm-hmm. They have basically no navy.
Yep.
Why would you not set up some kind of blockade around King's Landing to not let them land their troops?
Yeah, I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense. But we've seen time and time again that none of the battle plans have made any sense.
Nope. It's too bad. It's too bad.
That's just how it goes now. So the Hound and Arya get stopped on their way into the city by, I think, one of the Stark men.
Yep.
And they tell him they're on their way to kill the queen, which sort of confuses him.
It's funny. It's a good. It's a funny scene.
It is. Yeah. It's very good. And they continue through.
Yeah.
As this guy presumably runs off, actually presumably just keeps it to himself.
Yeah. Right. Go like, talk to your captain.
Right. By the time that's done, they're in.
It reminded me of the scene in the Avengers where like Captain America and the Black Widow and Hawkeye are commandeering a fighter jet, and one of the like mooks comes up and is like, "You're not supposed to." And Captain America's like, "Son, just don't." Like, what? Like, okay, you're going to go talk to your captain. While you do that, we're going to keep going under no threat. Like, come on. Come on. You don't even have a name. You're not even credited. I'm the fucking Hound. This is fucking
we'll get to
Night
credited
King
names.
Slayer. Yeah.
I was asking myself after this episode, why isn't Arya using any face at this point? Because it'd be sort of the perfect time. Sneaking into King's Landing would make a lot of sense to, and especially like in front of the Hound, like to prove... once and for all to the Hound that she has supreme ability, like that she is the warrior that he always thought she couldn't be.
Right.
Like, show her take a face right in front of the Hound.
Yeah.
It would be able to explain a lot to us as an audience of how this whole thing works. It would be able to, like I said, cement it in the Hound's mind, who she is. all of this would make sense. And even in the context of him saying, you don't want to be me,
sure,
at the end, it would make it maybe more powerful. I think what they're doing, though, mm-hmm. is they're saving this for Danny, mm. potentially.
Maybe.
Like, I really do think that we will get Arya doing some face shit in this last episode.
Because she didn't even do that to kill the Night King. Like, if her yeah. her big face heist was killing Walder Frey in Westeros.
But who is the Night King going to let close enough to him that a face would matter?
Yeah, no, I get it. I'm just saying that, like, it's I don't feel like they've quite paid off those abilities yet.
I agree, which is why I think they're going to try and pay him off mm-hmm. next episode.
I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, okay. Then we're all in agreement here.
Yes.
Let's move on to Tyrion going to see the imprisoned Jaime.
The stupidest Lannister.
Yes, I would agree. He releases Jaime with the condition that he at least try to convince Cersei to give up and leave King's Landing via this boat that he apparently gets from Davos. There's a tearful goodbye when Tyrion thanks Jaime for being the reason he survived his childhood. And I went into this scene going, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
And I came out of this scene going, slow clap, bravo. Like, they kind of nailed it at the end,
Like, I guess I didn't. The thing that made it work for me is the whole time I'm like, Tyrion, how can you think that this is going to, how can you, but like, at the end, and I'm about to compare this to Jaime, he says, he's like, hey, look, if you do this, your queen's going to execute you. And Tyrion says, oh, you know, if I win the war without firing a shot, maybe she'll forgive him. And then Jaime kind of looks at him. He's like, all right, 10,000 innocent people are worth one not so innocent dwarf. He's very like, that tells me that Tyrion knows that even if he successfully completes this mission, he's going to be killed by Dany. He's making a noble sacrifice. This stands in contrast to Jaime saying, I never much cared for the innocents.
Oh my God.
Like, I think for symmetry to happen, that Tyrion has to be like, bullshit. Your entire character has been defined by the fact that you, unlike your sister, can't not care about innocence.
Yeah. I mean, this is a man who traded his honor and a lifetime of eating shit
mm-hmm.
from everyone in the realm
yeah.
to save the innocents.
Yes. And he has done things to...
And not just the innocents. These innocents in particular.
Right.
People that he says I never cared for.
Yes.
This line is a huge mistake.
Yes.
This line is ignoring everything that makes Jaime Jaime.
And if you want to... I buy that he's saying that as like a Lannister bravado, but I wish Tyrion had called him on it the same way Jaime called Tyrion on his, like, oh, well, maybe the queen will give mercy. He's like, I wish Tyrion would be like, I don't believe that. And Jaime's like, well, you're right. You know, like,
but here's the problem. Let's grant that this is bravado and that Jaime does care. Well, then it fundamentally undermines his character that he goes back and doesn't actually care about the innocents. He's only there to comfort Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go the other way. And let's say that he actually never cared. Well, he's only cared for Cersei and he never cared about the innocents. And somehow that lines up with being the Kingslayer, which it doesn't. But let's say, does that not completely undermine everything they've done between him and Brienne?
I think
that speech
like
in that bathtub is a fucking lie to her face.
Yeah.
This breakdown of this man at his most vulnerable moment was all an elaborate lie.
Right.
That makes no sense in the context of those episodes.
Right.
Zero.
No,
Either way that you want to read that line, it is wrong.
And
it
is
just wrong.
I think there's a way they could have told a story where Jaime's trying to stop Cersei and trying to kill her. But when he finally gets to her, it's too late because Dany's gone crazy. So, like, he's like, well,
sure,
I could kill her for no good, this woman. Because, like, you know, Cersei just pathetic at the end of this episode. I could be like, you know what? And it would be almost like a moment of grace for, like, Jaime to, like, you know what? I'm going to try to go out as peacefully and as with as little bitterness as possible. But the fact that it turns out all along he's got this addiction to Cersei, I just feel like that is not the story that they were trying to tell for eight seasons for Jaime Lannister.
This man does care.
It's not a character arc. It's a character circle. It's a epic swerve. It's a justice subversion with no setup. And I feel as strongly about this as anything.
Yeah, I think this is actually the worst part of the episode.
It's not
the
about
worst
like
line.
Jaime didn't have to be the one to kill Cersei. That's not the problem. It's this. I never much cared for innocence, and for that to be standing, for that to like seem like the episode believing. And if you go behind the episode or underneath the episode or through the episode's asshole, whatever the thing's called, like I feel like the double D's, what they say is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nonsense.
It is. We'll get to that when Danny burns the city.
Okay.
I want to point out here also that Tyrion understood the nod that Danny gave to Grey Worm to be one of acknowledgement. This is the new plan.
Sure.
Because he tells Jaime, ring the bells, open the gates. That's all we have to do here. And Danny will stand down.
Yeah. And also, like you said, bravo. Like, it's even with all the problems of this, I think that the moment where Tyrion breaks down and says, you're the reason I survived childhood, and the fact that he's freeing Tyrion or Jaime in the exact same situation that Tyrion freed, Jaime freed Tyrion.
Yeah.
Like, if Tyrion hadn't killed Tywin, Jaime's in a lot of trouble. Like, the only reason that, like, you know, like that's committing very high treason. It's like, it's like very equivalent exchange. And these brothers loving each other makes a lot of sense. I don't know. I don't like the fact that Tyrion seems like he has a soft spot for Cersei and that Jaime still has a soft spot for Cersei.
And how much more poetic is it that if Jaime had let Tyrion go and Tyrion kills their father, Tyrion lets Jaime go and Jaime kills Cersei?
Kevin C. Sent a link to or mentioned an interview with Nikolai Coster-Waldau. I probably butchered his name.
Probably.
Where he
know.
Says that he had to create his own headcanon for why Jaime returned to Cersei so abruptly because his character's progression didn't make sense to him. And this reminded me a lot of, like, remember we used to go to the old Walker Stalker cons back when The Walking Dead was transitioning from attempted prestige drama about zombies into total horseshit? And...
Yeah, like
panel after
four-ish.
Panel, it was actors like being asked things and they were saying like, you know what? Yeah, it didn't make sense to us. But then, you know, we kind of worked out that maybe what happened, and like they were clearly doing the work that the writers weren't willing to do. And this, like, these seasons are the first time I started hearing that from the cast of Game of Thrones. And there's super cuts.
Conlith, the guy who plays Varys,
right?
He also said basically the same thing. Like, I thought my character was underserved. I thought it was weak. I didn't have much to do in these final seasons.
Right.
And he was ultimately disappointed in the role that Varys had
in
the final seasons. And not simply because, oh, I wasn't in the show much.
Right.
More because Varys has always been a character who very much gets involved in these situations.
And to be fair, there's supercuts of people put together like an 8-minute video of everyone having allegedly negative reactions to this season. And I think a lot of that's way overplayed.
Yeah, sure.
But no, like when they say specific things, like it's hard to argue that Varys wasn't underserved these last few seasons. It's hard to argue that this is what everyone not was expecting and it's subverted, but just like this is actually what people, this is the way that, this is the way to tell the story of Jaime being addicted to Cersei. I don't know. Big problem for me.
Yeah, me too. The Golden Company lines up against the Northern forces. Tyrion tells Jon that the bells mean surrender, and Arya and the Hound make it into the Red Keep just as they shut the gates, but Jaime's a little too late, so he tries to find an alternate way inside. I thought it was nice, or well, it was actually evil. Though he didn't know it, the Hound sort of causes this woman and her child to be trapped outside the city directly. They're literally the last ones or the first ones to get shut out of the city.
Right. It feels like a callback to the Hound stealing the silver from the farmer.
Yeah.
And you find out that he's like another just like a thoughtless action on his single-minded focus on his revenge has doomed another innocent family.
And if Arya had pointed it out, he probably would have said they're dead anyway.
Right.
And so am
right.
I.
He'd
and so are
right.
you.
He'd
and,
probably
yeah.
be right.
Right.
I love the shot of like the leader of the Golden Company, Harry Strickland, how they show like over his head and shoulders, you see in the distance John's army. And it's kind of like an inverse of the Battle of the Bastards, something that Miguel Sapochnik pointed out in the Game of Thrones revealed stuff. I thought that's great because it's foreshadowing the fact that you're about to see Jon and the Unsullied and the Dothraki and all of our quote unquote heroes act like the villains. Kind of revealing that in war, there is very little difference between good and evil other than their objectives. Like, you know,
sure.
So I thought that stuff was all really good. All the establishing shots, the city looking beautiful. There's this gorgeous shot of Cersei looking at, and you can see the ruined dragon pit and just all of King's Landing. And it just looks so fucking real. Just can't believe how beautiful it all looks.
I mean, the effects just get better and better because this next scene where Danny attacks the scorpions, both ship mounted and wall mounted, completely wiping out every single one of them, it looks amazing.
Yeah, and her attack coming out of the sun, I thought, was a great way to say what's different about this time.
Yeah,
and then her,
I've learned a little bit.
Her going there and then swooping down low so that the guns of King's Landing have to completely, you know, depress their aim and then have Drogon swoop up and torch them. It's a little, like, even having said that, this would not be a problem if last episode didn't exist, because it's
sure.
even with all the stuff they did to explain how Dany did it, it seems hard to believe that she had zero problems pulling this off.
Yeah, it's just a question of accuracy. And
yeah,
look, I get it. The sun is in their face, and I like how, you know, John lines up in where he puts Harry Strickland's face right into the sun.
Yeah,
I mean, this is no pun intended, Sun Tzu.
Yeah,
basic art of war shit, right?
Sure.
Like, this has been known for thousands of years.
Yeah, and it's like basic World War I, World War II aerial tactics. I just wish that there's someone put together a really cool, like, reimagining of last episode scene where they told the story. So it's the exact same footage, but they recut it to where it happens this way. Dany's flying high. She sees Euron's fleet and thinks, ah, this fucker's going to try to ambush me again. So she takes her two dragons, because she's still got Rhaegal with her, into the dive. And then the mass volley of the crossbolts drives her away. And then they cut to Rhaegal getting shot down from, they imply, from the mat. Like, that makes a lot of sense. That, like, if you can get the, that these things aren't just, like, accurate from miles away, and you can, like, track moving dragons. Like, I don't know, like, they could have told that. No one forced them. No one put a gun to their head and said that you have to kill Rhaegal in this surprise, shocking faction with unerring machine gun style crossbow accuracy. But they did. So now,
I just feel like they should have saved that for now. Like, I'm with you. Like,
oh, I'm about, like, wait till we get, there's a suggestion that we'll get to in Dany Turns Evil that I think is, like, closed book. This is how they should have done it. And I cannot believe dozens of high-paid writers didn't see it. It's hard to believe. Anyway.
So one thing I wanted to point out, which I thought was hilarious, and I posted this in our forums, Euron, in this scene, he gets subtitled as Soldier One when he's yelling to his crew to turn the guns around, which is just, like, as useless and pointless as Euron has been this entire time, and how much people are just like, who the fuck is this guy? Why do we care? To label him as some nameless soldier in the captions is great.
Plus, he's drinking out of a Yeti cup. I mean, that's the why he's doing it. That's the thing that really threw me.
Neil's just cracking cups. but the funnier thing, I think, though, or maybe the sadder thing, is that the production team completely ignores, because there are two people shouting turn it around here. One is Euron, nameless soldier one. The other is a guy on his boat. What is wrong, Aaron, with a guy on his boat shouting turn it around?
I thought they were mutes.
I did the show did too, as of like an episode ago, two episodes ago.
Theon's 20 dudes killed every person on Euron's boat, so he had to reluctantly crew with people who could talk.
And he put him in the garb of his people.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't let them wear their Lannister armor. He was if you're coming on my boat, you're going to wear our fucking robes. Yeah.
Indeed.
That's suspect. But it's just like, it's so sloppy. It's just it's indicative of the care that they put into this final season.
Right.
I would be willing to forgive it in a better episode, kind of like I forgive the Starbucks coffee cup. It's like you can't catch everything. I get it, but it just, there's a pattern after a while that you see where they just don't try hard enough.
Yeah, suspension of disbelief is like an anti-gravity device. Like, they don't fail gracefully. Like, they, like, once you, like, if you're a mile high over the surface of the Earth and you got your anti-gravity system on and it fails, you crash. You don't, like, smoothly descend when that, and suspension of disbelief is the same way. Once you get to your breaking point, wherever that is, and if you're like Dany, maybe you don't even have to breaking point at all. You can just decide to, like, not have your, like, once that fails, I've seen it time and time again. That's when that's when the quote unquote nitpicking comes out. Because all the shit that you would have ignored because you're down with the story now becomes, you're looking for the justification of why you're not liking it.
And if you want to say I'm picking nits here, I am.
Sure. Yeah.
I am. But like you said,
they're sizable nits. And the show didn't used to have an infestation of these nits that needed to be picked.
I mean, they're nits that have been directly contradicted in the plot that they spell out on the screen earlier. Like,
the previous
episode. That's the most egregious thing. They say, oh, all of his crew are mutes. Like, that, how can you then, never mind. Forget it. All right, Qyburn reports the bad news. The ballistas are gone. The Scorpion's done. The Iron Fleet is gone. The Golden Company is gone. Cersei thinks they're going to win. She's pretty secure in her belief that the Red Keep has never fallen. It won't today.
Yeah.
The Lannisters will fight to their last, the very last man.
We had in last week's episode, the spoiler edition, someone wrote in about like the fact that they rebuilt this Dubrovnik set in Northern Ireland and Belfast. Actually, I'm not sure if that's somewhere. I'm not sure if that's Northern Ireland or Ireland or what. But they built this thing, and it was like the gist of it was just to avoid spoilers leaking out. But it's clear to me that they had to build this set to do the destruction of King's Landing proper. And I was amazed at how much practical effects. And I think it was worth it because these large CG battles, sometimes they're not quite convincing, but having men actually be on fire, having a giant gate actually explode with all these gasoline rigs, having these this destruction actually happen on a large set, we haven't seen that since Lord of the Rings, and it led to an utterly convincing battle. It led to an utterly convincing battle.
I agree, and one where I truly felt the power of this dragon.
Did you see one thing I want to point out? I might put this in the show notes. This guy named Tabaxi Taxidermist on the subreddit r/Game of Thrones released patch notes for episode 5, and he did,
you
like...
told me about this.
It's really funny because if you're a video gamer, you know that like when your favorite game gets patched, everyone goes through and sees like what got nerfed, what got buffed, and they had like, he had like bullet points like Scorpions get nerfed in this episode, significantly reduced accuracy. Hero character you're on no longer gives bonus to Scorpion accuracy. There's what was the other one? Northerners and Unsullied both have reduced honor and morality meters. It's now possible for them to commit war crimes with little to no provocation. Euron plot armor has now been removed. It's just really, really funny stuff. So if you hate the episode, it's funny. If you like the episode, it probably is annoying. I'll link it in the show notes.
Let's move on. Lannister forces, faced with certain death, decide to surrender.
I really like this tense standoff felt like really, really cool. And then Dany lands on the walls and intimidates the fuck out of everybody. The Lannister soldiers all throwing down their swords. It's great.
I'm going to pick a nit.
Okay.
The Lannisters have their helmets open in this scene. They're squaring off against the Stark forces. And their helmet's completely open.
Grey Worm's not even wearing his anymore. Like, I just think, like, this is true. This is, like, one of those bizarre things where, like, I don't understand what the decision to have the face, like, all the faceless mooks have to have their faces showing. Like,
it's weird. It's almost scarier and more intimidating if they don't.
Yeah, but I think that they really wanted you to see the battle going on in the Lannisters between our loyalty to our house and, oh, geez, this is certain death. And you needed to see...
That's told with a close-up of the sword in their hand and a close-up of the sword dropping.
I agree, but I think it's a defensible artistic decision to want to see their eyes darting and their eyebrows
knitting.
This
is why
I said
it's a nit I'm picking. Yeah, I think for the most part, this was a very tense moment.
Yes.
Like, they created a lot of tension here, especially when you see, like, Dany watching the city, Tyrion watching the bell, Cersei watching Dany and her dragon.
Yeah.
Let's, I guess, keep going. The bells ring, signaling surrender, which is exactly when Dany decides to burn everyone. Mm-hmm. Grey Worm takes this as a cue to start killing, and the Northmen, for some inexplicable reason, ignore the King of the North as he shouts orders not to follow suit. They murder, rape, and pillage King's Landing.
Okay, so let's take this one at a time, because I think some of this stuff is more defensible than you're letting on.
Okay, let me ask you this, though, because I don't think this is very defensible.
Okay.
Why is Grey Worm here?
Why wouldn't he be?
Where are the Unsullied?
They're with him.
No, they're not.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am.
This is just the Northmen.
This is all Northmen. This is Jon and the Northmen. Unsullied or nowhere
to be
seen.
I don't know where the Unsullied went, because the Unsullied, the Dothraki, and the Northmen all charged the gate simultaneously.
Maybe I'm wrong, and they're in the way back, and they're not getting in the shot.
Well, they have that weird way of moving, where they have to take one half step at a time, you know?
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
shout
the Dothraki
every time
go
they do
first, because they're on horseback. The Northerns are just screaming and running, and then the Dothraki, or the Unsullied, are doing their lockstep thing.
Yeah, it seemed to me it was Dothraki leading the charge on their horses, Unsullied right behind them with Grey Worm leading them, commanding them.
Getting a lot. This is feeling like the smallest of nits.
Yeah, but...
We got bigger nits to pick.
But, like, this whole situation goes down entirely differently if Grey Worm isn't there. So I was just questioning, like, why.
Does it?
Yeah, because he's the spark. Mm. He's the spark for the Lannister men to... Or, not the Lannister men, the Stark men to go all apeshit on the Lannisters.
But I think it's once Danny burning the city is the spark.
No. Yeah. No, watch it. Watch it again.
But
John's there to tell everyone to calm the fuck down, and they're his men, and he's the king in the north. He can hold this situation. I fully believe.
If
Grey Worm doesn't spark it off,
I just disagree. I think that like maybe it takes 5 seconds, maybe it takes 10, but once the whole city is on fire and Danny's doing it, like I think it's inevitable. Because here's the thing. I think it's very realistic that the Northerners, the Unsullied, and the Dothraki all fucking go apeshit because the North fucking remembers. This is the city that killed their beloved Ned Stark. This is the people that have betrayed and backstabbed and killed them and tricked them and humiliated them and exploited their honor and their integrity and their will. So they got a reason to hate these people and see vengeance done. The Unsullied, supposedly the incorruptible army that was not going to rape and pillage cities because that's not what they do. They're inhumanly trained not to do it, have been taught that they're individuals and they have pride and they love their freedom, and they just saw one of their slave sisters re-enslaved and thrown off a fucking wall. So they're led by Grey Worm and he's ready to go ape shit. And the Dothraki don't need a fucking reason. That's like their default. Sure. They're throttle stuck in like batshit battle crazy anyway. So like all three of these factions, if it wasn't Grey Worm, it'd been somebody, because they're falling off their lead. And like, it is kind of funny because John's like, stop killing. Lannister soldier comes forward. He disembowels him. Stop the senseless violence. Another one comes forward. He's asked to hack that guy to death. Like there's no way.
It's funny, but
he
obviously has to defend himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Once the rout comes on, there's no way he can stop it because he's the only guy.
Yeah, I agree with that. He's shell shocked in the moment when he sees Danny burning the city. Mm-hmm. He sees his own troops attacking. He's not going to immediately try and quell this. He's going to be shocked, which he was.
But let's talk the big enchilada here.
Yeah.
Danny's on the wall. She's waiting to see if presumably the bells will ring because she doesn't start this immediately.
No.
And there's all these people crying out, help us, please, someone ring the bell, ring the bell for God. Like there's all these cries and she hears it. Like how is this not the people crying out for a savior? The bell finally rings and then she starts burning the city down. And she takes to the sky, and I thought they were going to tell the story of her just, like, burning the Red Keep. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting because this is a legitimate military tactic or target, but Cersei's surrounded with innocent people, and it's going to be Dany thinks she's justified, and Jon still is sickened by the loss of innocent life. Well, she just starts torching the entire civilian population.
Yeah.
It's
indefensible.
I don't get it. And there's ways like, okay, let's say you don't kill Rhaegar last episode. Let's say that Dany takes Rhaegar into battle with her, and since she doesn't trust Jon anymore, she forbids him to ride him or whatever. And so Rhaegar's up on the wall screaming at everybody the same way Drogon does. And what if, so the bells ring, the battle's over, but someone between Cersei or Qyburn or probably Euron just unilaterally decides to shoot one last crossbow bolt and it kills Rhaegal. Now you got Dany legitimately fucking losing her shit. Like she sees that she's been betrayed. She suspects Tyrion. She suspects Jon. One of her children has been murdered after the battle has already been won. After she single-handedly wins this surgical battle. How is that just not straight up better? How is that not straight up better?
Yeah, no, I can think of, and I've seen on the fan communities here, 50 different ways that this plays out that make far more sense in the moment than this did.
And I want to make a comparison to the Red Wedding here, because I think this is key, because a lot of people in the email said, you know, there's no difference between this and the Red Wedding, you just don't like it. Okay, what if the Red Wedding happened, and when Rob got to the twins, he goes to Walder Frey says, you know what, Walder? I've been really thinking about it, and I did you dirty. I'm going to set it. You're right. I was immature. I'm going to set aside Talisa, and I'm going to marry your daughter, and she'll be queen of the North. Does Walder Frey still go through at the Red Wedding with that fat, like, Like suddenly
possibly
that,
not, yeah.
That changes the mathematics. Or better yet, what if Rob never betrayed him in the first place? What if he hadn't lost? Like, they told the story of literally everything going Danny's way, and she just decides to rule through fear by destroying an entire civilian pipeline, something she's never, ever done before.
Yeah, something she's decried many times. Like, I want to help these people. Yes. You know, I am the breaker of chains. I
want to break the wheel of tyranny.
Yeah.
And again, there's you can make an argument that this was all foreshadowed. I just needed. And the other thing is, like, I don't feel like the Double D's did a great job of telling the story. Because, like, I think my understanding is that Dani just went insane. She went mad queen. But it seems like in the interview sessions, they take great pains to say that, no, Dani's not going crazy.
Well, here's the thing is they say that this is all premeditated. And, yes. like their paraphrased quote here is that this is premeditated. And when she's sitting on the wall and the bells are ringing and she sees the keep, she decides to make this personal is exactly what
she
they say.
She decided to make this personal. Why?
Which, I mean, that is them saying, like, this was not premeditated. Mm-hmm. So everybody who's saying, like, oh, that nod to Grey Worm meant actually nothing, meant the exact opposite of what I, as a viewer, thought that it meant, is undercut by the creators of the show telling you this is not what we had it in our minds when we created these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, making this personal, what does making this personal have to do with the people of King's Landing?
That's the
innocence of King's Landing.
You
want to free of tyranny.
When she says, like, decide to make it personal, it's personal between her and Cersei.
Yes.
Like, and that's still already shocking. And the other thing is,
to,
like,
take out the Red Keep and the collateral damage, yes.
That would be
shocking.
It would already be enough to probably push Jon and Davos and Tyrion over the edge. The other thing, I guess, is, like, even if Rhaegal had died the way I just outlined it, like, it still doesn't excuse her burning the city. It's still clearly a massive overreaction that you wouldn't want from a righteous leader.
Oh, it's immoral.
It's a much, much more understanding. This, just her deciding to make it personal and deciding that the people of King's Landing are the ones that were firing the crossbow bolts at her and the ones that killed her friend. Like, there is a person that did that. It's Qyburn. It's Cersei. It's Euron. These people are crying out to be saved from these fucking people. They hate her as much as anyone. They just, like...
And she's gotten the thing that she's always wanted, which is to take back the Red Keep for her fucking family.
But now she's going to destroy it.
She's not even on the precipice of having gotten it. She got it.
She did it. She has one. She's won a complete... And, like, maybe... Like, again, she wants to burn down the Red Keep, but honestly, Cersei's done. Like...
Yeah, and you march your troops in there, you kill her, and you're done.
And when they show her face, you can see it even on Cersei's face, that for the first time she realizes, I'm done.
Yeah.
And if they did enough for you to believe that this is Dany, then I actually am kind of envious of you, because the whole rest of this episode just fucking works.
It does, yeah.
But to me,
it's horrifying. It's terrible.
And again, I don't think it's too much to ask. If you're going to ask the secondary or primary hero, depending on how you want to look at it, if you're going to turn them to the dark side, I don't think it's too much to ask for them to do a little bit better job. Because, like, to me, this is very Anakin Skywalker, where, yeah, sure, he murdered. The problems are almost exactly the same. I didn't fully buy his relationship with Padme. I didn't fully buy his friendship with Obi-Wan. I didn't fully buy him just killing the sand people in this contrived way. And then, like, the scene where he turns to the dark side, in a 15-minute span, he goes to Mace Windu, gains everything he wanted, which is the trust and prestige of the Jedi Council. Mace Windu goes to arrest the person that needs to be arrested, and then he's like, oh shit, then my girl dies, I can't bring her back. Then he betrays Mace Windu. Then he falls to his knees and says, what have I done? The Emperor says, go kill all the younglings. And then, like, I'm sorry. I think there's a lot more in common with Dany's fall to the dark side with Anakin Skywalker than any other. Like, the perfect way that this has been done was Walter White in Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And as a person that covered that in
real
time. And
it took many seasons to get there.
And the thing is, you're at the end of Breaking Bad, there were still a few defenders of Walter White. Just as in the beginning of Breaking Bad, there was a few people that said, nah, I'm not rooting for him. He's a bastard the whole time. But you look at how the audience, like, you can tell whether they've done their job by how many people kind of go along with it. And when you see this kind of mixed reaction, it is a failure of storytelling, because people are not out to get this show. They want to love this show.
I want to love this show.
I want to love this show.
I struggled. I went back through whatever catalog of this show that I have in my head, and I looked at the previous episodes in seasons of yore, seasons 1 through 4, and I tried to think of a single scene in a single episode that dissatisfied me, that was less than excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't think of a single damn scene in all of the first 4 seasons of Game of Thrones that let me down in any way.
Yeah.
And now here we are in season 8, shortcutting our way to a 13 episode double season that is so fundamentally flawed in the understanding of these characters and what drives them and what will push them over the edge in certain scenarios. I look back and I just say, man, what could have been?
And I'm sympathetic to the people that says, you know, if you ignore the small stuff and you just go with the broad strokes, this actually tracks and it's very Game of Thrones. It's probably something like a lot of the stuff is probably... But I just wish that like it's... Like, they didn't do the small stuff right, and then I can't go along with them on the big stuff. Like, I guess if you just like I think episode 3 of Star Wars works if you just go along with it as, like, this gothic opera that kind of works on some kind of intuitive emotional level and doesn't maybe make logical sense.
Yeah.
But you know what? I said, well, I was pretty much fucked George Lucas on that one, too. So...
No, I have been saying all along, you can go back and you can listen to the podcast. I have been saying this, they have very well told the story of Dany being on the edge of her.
The coin being flipped and spinning in the air.
Yes, they have told that story so well. Yeah. I could so believe it. And I've never been on the side of like, I will riot if Dany goes evil. I think that's a perfectly valid outcome for this character. They just didn't quite make it across the finish line for me in telling that story.
Like, if Miss Sandy died in front of her eyes and she just instantly went berserk, like, there needed to be...
Walk off the screen in that last episode, get on your fucking dragon and burn this place to the ground.
Because Dany is a dragon that can be waked and can be act irrational, can get, like, ahead of herself, but she doesn't premeditated murder a bunch of civilians for
Never.
No reason. They have not. I
Never.
Don't think they've told that story.
And they didn't give me a reason to believe that she had changed her mind about that.
Yeah. And if you think they have, I'm very happy for you.
Yeah.
I wish I
this
was
is probably
along with you.
One of the best episodes of Game of Thrones, if you believe that.
Because again, the first half of this works. The second half, again, I think accepting the Jaime shit, but it would be another case where it's like, well, you know, they had a couple bumpy roads, but. So one more final point. From a book perspective, there's actually a lot of really subtle textual clues for Dany's eventual fall, and they start surprisingly early. For example, when Daenerys is introduced to us, she frequently remembers her childhood home in Braavos, where her and her brother first lived in exile, because it's the only safe, happy, secure environment she's ever known. And she finally recalls the lemon tree that grew outside her home, and most prominently, the big, bright red door that adorned the entrance. In just her third POV chapter, in the very first book, Game of Thrones, she had these thoughts as she tried to focus her mind's eye on Westeros.
But it was not the plains Dany saw then. It was King's Landing and the great red keep that Aegon the Conqueror had built. It was Dragonstone, where she had been born. In her mind's eye, they burned with 1,000 lights, a fire blazing in every window. In her mind's eye, all the doors were red.
If you'd like to join the legions of book readers who have and will continue to comb through the books looking for great bits of potential foreshadowing like this, Audible is a great way to experience the saga. And you can start listening today with a 30-day Audible trial, which gets you your first audiobook plus 2 Audible originals for free. Every book in George Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series is available on Audible's site, all in a convenient app that allows you to listen everywhere you are. At the gym, in your car, mowing your lawn. And if you're not happy with your choices, audiobook exchanges are free and easy. Your credits roll over for up to a year, and you keep your existing library even if you cancel. So start listening today to begin your free 30-day trial. Visit audible.com/GOT or text GOT to 500-500.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah.
Jaime continues to make his way to Cersei. Euron finds him on the beach, and they fight. Jaime is stabbed in the side with a foot-long dagger. Jaime gets stabbed again in the other side, but he's able to kill Euron, and he makes his way under the walls as Euron gloats about killing Jaime Lannister. Kind of two scenes that I combined here, but...
And here's the thing. This, I think, is completely indefensible. The fact that Euron would be blown off his boat...
By
swim
dragon
to
fire,
this
lethal.
Spot at this, like, there is a 1-minute gap where this scene works,
mm-hmm.
And again, if this was the only problem I had with the episode, then maybe you could decry me as a nitpicker. But Euron, has he ever done anything but swoop in at the last minute through some crazy coincidence and luck and do some devastating thing to a major character that we love? Has he done anything but that in his entire existence of Game of Thrones?
Maybe when he's first introduced at the Kingsmoot. Maybe?
Yeah, and
if I'm being generous.
And he comes home swaggering and he fucks Cersei.
He fucks the queen.
But like all of his big moments are just unearned moments of triumph.
Can you imagine if they took, instead of Euron killing Jaime or wounding Jaime mortally, if they just had, like you said, this Rhaegal thing where Euron is just like, I fucked the queen, as he fires the last ballista bolt that goes right into Rhaegal, setting Dany off. I would totally see that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that'd be amazing.
And the other thing is, this goes back to like when they gutted Arya and threw her into that filthy canal. I just don't know why they do, like, why did Jaime have to get run through his guts twice by an 18-inch dagger?
Yeah.
Like,
it's a little unbelievable.
I just feel like they continually, in the last two or three or four seasons, are doing this thing, and they do it multiple times this episode, as we're about to discuss.
I mean, they do it multiple times in this scene. They stab him in the sides, but they stab Euron in the guts, and Euron's completely incapacitated by it.
Right. I don't...
Unable to stand up, even.
Yeah, When characters used to take fatal damage on this show, it was fatal. And there's a couple noticeable examples, like the Hound being left for dead, all that kind of stuff. But, like, increasingly, they've done this horse shit where they're trying to generate what is a fan reaction by putting characters in mortal danger and not killing them. But the problem is, just as Walking Dead learned to its sorrows, you can only do that so many times before the fans stop caring, it just comes across as plot armor.
Yeah, I mean, they do it with Jaime, Brienne, Pod, Sam, Tyrion.
Yeah.
Last episode with the mask coming down on his head.
Yeah.
They undermine the truly impressive work that they do at conveying the power of Dragonfire by having Euron be totally fine after getting hit by a near direct hit, after having Arya get up totally fine after getting hit with a near direct hit.
Also,
they undermine the great work that they've done there by not killing these characters in these situations.
And I'm trying, I was also,
or
just
not
like,
putting them in them in the first place.
It's just also just such a pointless thing, because Jaime never really, I mean, the whole story about Jaime is he's not a warrior anymore.
Sure.
And, like, I guess he did kick enough ass last episode, but, like, it was kind of borderline shocking to me that he was able to beat Euron.
Yeah.
Like, even with a grievous injury. And I guess, you know, Euron didn't have a sword, and Euron had just gotten blown off the boat, and Euron had just fucking swam 3 miles from in the shore. But it's just, I don't know, this is profoundly silly, and that's saying nothing about the giant coincidence about this particular date, time and place.
Yeah.
There's, like, 100 feet ashore and 30 seconds of chronological time for these people to meet. And I don't, like, nope. My suspension of disbelief is not powerful enough to make me believe nor care about this. Because I also don't understand why Euron gets this moment.
That's the bigger disappointment in my mind, is that Euron is a nothing of a character that gets to arguably kill one of the most beloved or hated characters in the entire series.
Right.
Why does he get that moment?
I don't know.
He doesn't deserve it. All right, Qyburn, seeing their imminent loss, takes Cersei to Maker's Holdfast. I don't know how much you want to say about that. Cersei definitely sees, she's done.
So it's like, you know, like, this is a cool little detail. Like, Maker's Holdfast is this, like, squat little square castle within the castle. And if you'll recall in season one, I think it's season one, where Joffrey was tormenting Sansa by making her look at her father's head on a spike, and they cross that drawbridge that she almost jumped off with all those spikes. That's actually Maegor's Holdfast. Like, there's this like a giant moat that's got a drawbridge. Like, even if you defeat the Red Keep, then you have to also, and it's got like 12-foot thick walls. It's built to be impregnable. So like, that's where he's suggesting to retreat, and I thought that was kind of cool. Now, outside, as Qyburn is ushering her away, we start to see wildfire caches start to explode. I'm not quite sure what they're going with this, whether this is literally like, Mad King Aerys, wildfire, dragonfire, or if it's like,
Mad King Aerys Danny,
or if it's like, But it's, it kind of has a side effect of like letting Danny off the hook a bit, because it's entirely possible that these wild card, like that Cersei would have blown these and burnt the city down anyway.
There's a third possibility. I mean, there are probably a lot of possibilities, but another one is that these are leftover from Mad King Aerys' days, which I kind of like the most.
Yeah.
But these, you know, he notoriously hid them throughout the city. Maybe they weren't all found.
What cinematic motif is it serving to have them going off at this moment?
Well, the same one as it would have if, like, I mean, this is the elbow, the wink, nudge, mm-hmm. Danny Mad King thing, right? I think it serves that purpose as well.
Yeah, okay.
Just to remind us that Aerys exists, and this is about what would happen if he were to have executed his plan.
Yeah.
But then you also have to be reminded that Jaime was the defender of the people there, mm-hmm. which is sort of unfortunate. So Arya and the Hound arrive in the map room. The Hound tells her to go home because Cersei's already dead, and says, "You don't want to become me, consumed by hatred," essentially. And Arya asks him, or thanks him, sorry, as he leaves to hunt down his brother.
Does this feel like an earned moment for Arya?
Yes, I think so. I think the connection, this is one of the strongest connections that mm-hmm. they've developed over the course of these 8 seasons, or pretty close to 8 seasons, 7. Mm-hmm. I think they've done a really good job with Arya and the Hound. And in my opinion, the only person who could have backed her down at this point is mm-hmm. the Hound.
I just wish they had played her a little bit more ambivalent with Gendry. I wish she'd played her a little bit more ambivalent with Nymeria. Like, everything to me tells me a story of, like, it's too late for this little girl. She's seen too much shit. She's been through too much shit. She's like, it's like, could the Hound have talked himself out of a life of vengeance if he, like, someone gone back and told his 18-year-old self, "You don't want to go down this path, Sandor. This path leads death." Like, isn't Arya at least that committed?
I mean, yeah, I could buy that argument.
I felt like, again, this is another one where I just didn't quite believe her switch from avenging Death Angel to scared little girl running for her life. I wish I did, but I didn't. I didn't.
Okay. Let's move on to the keep begins caving in on Cersei. The mountain, which I really like this moment, shields her from the falling rubble as the rest of the Kingsguard is falling around her dead.
It just shows just what the job in front of the Hound is. Like,
yeah, it's so good. And the lead up to this,
and you believe it. Like, when you see this 500-pound boulder like bounce off this guy, it's like, yeah, that's about right.
Yep.
With that armor, that body, he's undead, full of whatever magic Qyburn's pumped him full of. Like, it just sells. It just gets you hyped for the Clegane Bowl, what's about to happen.
And it's not the only thing they do, because the Clegane Bowl begins when the Hound walks up, but not before Qyburn's head is dashed to pieces on the wall by the mountain and Cersei slinks off.
No man's is as cursed as the Hype Slayer, I'm telling you.
That,
when
dude,
he comes in,
it's so amazing. The way Qyburn dies is spot on.
I also like when the Hound comes in and says "Your Grace" to the Queen and then "Hello, big brother," and the way the way the mountain just glares at Cersei when she says "Stay by my side," and his eyes are just you can tell that, like, no matter what kind of magic Qyburn's working, like, there's in whatever lizard part of his brain that's still working, mm-hmm. he hates his brother down to his fucking balls, and they just, like, nothing can stop this. Not any amount of Queensguard, not any amount of warlock, disgraced maesters.
It's perfect.
This is everything. This is the one thing that I think they completely nailed. Nailed everything about it.
Yeah. Then
I'm even not even mad that the Hound lets Cersei go, because I think that he fully believed that everyone at this, like, and then he was right.
After sending Arya away, he believes everyone is dead.
This deep in the castle, no one's getting out.
Yes.
Like, you might be able to get out if you're still in the Streets of Landing and you start leaving right now, but everybody else is dead. So he, like, I think it would have been cool if he had cut her down as, like he says, you know, if he had said, like, Arya Stark says hello and just cuts her down, but mm-hmm. then you wouldn't get the horseshit thing with Jaime. And, but yeah, no. Clegane Bowl, 10 out of 10, 11 out of 10, yep. A++++.
So we cut back and forth here between several scenes. It's Jaime and Cersei, it's the Hound, it's Arya, but
can I ask you this? Did you hear on the, I'm assuming you did, on the behind the scenes that they shot the Arya fleeing from King's Landing as a one-shot, a one-er?
No.
Yeah. Huh. So they shot this at probably great pains and expense as a single tracking shot of her going through King's Landing. And
they didn't use it as that, huh?
And in editing, they decided to intercut it with the Clegane Bowl. And I wonder if it's because they realized no one really cares to see 5 minutes of Arya trying to get out of King's Landing. Like, it's... I think that you do get a little battle fatigue when it's about an hour long of just like, as good as the special effects are. And it'd be, I think it'd work better if I was fully engaged in like all of the four different plots that they're trying to tell the story. And I was only really engaged with like John and Davos and like the Clegane Bowl. But like, it feels like to me, that's a storytelling failure. If they get into the editing bay and it's like, oh shit, this one we can't use because.
I think they made the right storytelling call in the end.
Oh, I do too.
I think what makes it to screen is what it's important there.
Yeah. But it's awkward because like I think that the way they cut the Clegane Bowl and Arya, they're telling a story, a connected story, like the Hound's on one trajectory and Arya's on another trajectory, but then they kept on kind of, for me, undercutting it by putting Arya in mortal danger. Like from my count, she dies from debris hitting her. She dies from dragon fire. She dies from being probably trampled to death and by the Dothraki running her down. Like, she should have died four or five times, and there's no reason why they kept endangering her again and again and again and again. It just felt...
I can feel you there.
Okay.
But I think they made the right choice, because I think even Clegane Bowl as a one-er, Clegane Bowl, like, all at once might have been too much. I think intercutting these scenes makes a lot of sense here.
Yeah.
It even more strongly connects Arya and the Hound and their, you know, potential fates here.
Yeah.
I think it breaks up the action, which could have got, you know, less exciting if it wasn't broken up.
Is this a good point to continue heaping praise upon the Clegane Bowl?
Sure, do it.
Because, like,
when he puts the sword straight through the mountain, but it doesn't faze him.
One of the things, so I wrote these books, godsofthrones.com, and one of the things we spent a lot of money on is hiring Chase Stone to do the artwork for the novels, or the books. And one of the things we had him illustrate is the Clegane Bowl. And it's one of my favorite illustrations, and he does this thing where the way he portrayed it, and Chase is kind of known in this, is the way he uses light in his art. And like this sunlight is streaming through the, you know, this coliseum they're fighting in. There's all these like vuvuzela trumpeters, but they just did this great job of like showing this bathe in like this almost like Renaissance looking painting. And that panel of the Hound at the bottom of the stairs and Gregor at the top and Drogon flying over is just fucking beautiful. And the fact that, like, when he's pulling the sword out of his chest and his head's framed by the sun, he's ripping off his armor, revealing his Frankenstein form. You've got this casting. You've got this Rory McCann who's like 6'6", a beast in his own right, and you literally have the world's strongest man in real life, fresh off the world's strongest man competition, and he's able to take Rory and throw him around like a child.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, when he's punching him, it looks like every one of those is a near fatal blow. And the Hound is like, he's got him choking and he's stabbing him and he's laughing because he can't believe he can't kill this guy. And he's like, why won't you fucking die? Like, all of this is so true to the Hound's character and felt so fucking satisfying. Oh, man. I just want to. There's one episode that I can go over the top with my praise. It's this.
All right. Arya is roaming the streets, witnessing the horror, the rubble falling all around her. She nearly gets trampled by the crowd as we cut between her and the Hound, both getting beaten brutally. Arya gets up and she's swept away by the crowd again while the Hound puts a dagger through Gregor's head. It still doesn't kill him, so the Hound takes him over the edge of the tower into the fire below. And what a poetic end. Well, what a beautiful end for the Hound. He gets the two things that I think he wants out of life, which is the mountain and death. It's a perfect end for Gregor.
And I was so sucked up to this the first time I was watching
Sandor.
For both of them.
For both of them, yeah.
When the mountain went in for his trademark, Prince Oberyn eye gouge,
yeah.
I'm like, oh,
this
shit.
This is going to go bad.
This is like, I'm not prepared for this kind of gut. Like, you know, the Hound dying, okay, but like him failing to kill the mountain. And then, so, like, it ends up with he stabs his brother. I just love the symmetry between his brother poking one of his eyes out and him stabbing his brother through the head and poking his eye out. The Hound realizing what he has to do, tackling through the wall, falling 500 feet into a raging inferno. That's just, yeah, that's how you fucking tie up a character arc right there.
I agree. So John's out there still in this chaos, and stuff, I think, starts to die down. So he tells everyone to fall back.
Plus, I think
suddenly they start listening to him again.
Also, the wildfire is going off. I think that's really why he's saying everyone needs to get out.
Yeah, shit's coming down around him.
He's also seen that there's interesting shots where John's seeing the Lannister soldiers, like, heroically trying to save civilians and ushering them. And, like, I mean, they do a great job of telling this part of the story, too, is war is hell.
Yeah.
Like, if you take men and women and you train them to effectively override the base human impulse of thou shalt not kill, I mean, this is why you really got to be careful. Let slip in the dogs of war, because this is what happens, man. Like, maybe not a big percentage of it happens. Maybe, like, depending on the morals of the society that they're fighting. But, like, this will always, always happen. War crimes and atrocity will always, always happen on both sides of any conflict, because this is just not human. Mm-hmm. This is a primitive part of our lizard brains that you're letting off the leash, and it doesn't matter good or bad. It's terrible to see. And I thought this feels very Martin as fuck too.
Yeah.
Because Martin is much more a confirmed pacifist than I am, and it's clear in his writing that he just abhors warfare.
So Arya wakes up covered in dust and rubble, having survived the attack, but just barely. She chokes her way through the streets, trying to help people escape while avoiding falling buildings and dragon fire. This is a nice scene here where she's trying to help these people desperately to get out of this house. And you talked about, you know, this Renaissance painting of the Hound and the Mountain on the stairs. There's yet another one here where she walks into these people, this place where they're huddled, looking for protection.
Yeah.
And it's a Renaissance painting. It's beautiful.
It is.
And it's frightening and it's scary. And Arya tries to get them out of there and she fails. She's forced to abandon them in order to save herself.
It's funny because on the Game of Thrones revealed or whatever, there's a clip where Maisie Williams says about these scenes, because we talked about the rubble, we talked about the fire, we talked about the Dothraki riding her down, but she says, what was the direct quote? Something along the lines of, I thought I had this written down. Something along the lines of, you know, we tried to trick the audience into believing that Arya is dead, but the audience is too smart for that.
Then why bother trying?
If you are cutting this thing together, like, then so is this the show admitting that they're treating us like idiots? If we're too smart for it, but they do it anyway.
Or is it them saying that they think we'll figure out that she didn't die because we're smart enough to know that
she
shouldn't die?
It felt a little bit like a confession.
I mean, a lot of that Thrones revealed stuff
really is
felt like a confession, as in we don't really know what we were thinking.
Yeah, or we. Stuff. But you know, this the double D's have a long history of me of like saying bizarre things on these shows, like clearly having Jamie rape Cersei and then be like, oh no, it was consensual, and then, you know, have something happen and it's supposed to be a dark side, but it's like understandable from my perspective. Or like here, you know, what they said about Dany just decided to make it personal. I mean,
I'm super inclined to give people the benefit of the doubt. About misspeaking. As a podcaster.
Sure. It happens.
Where, you know, we've been going for almost 2 hours here. There's probably a lot that I've said that I'll come to realize, oh yeah, I should have worded that differently. Mm-hmm. However, that's not what they're doing with Thrones Revealed. I don't assume that they sit down going, okay, bring on any question. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen these questions or anything. I assume they know what they're going to be talking about and they should have their heads on straight when they're speaking about it. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's complete chaos on the set of those things.
Maybe.
Like it is here. all right, Jamie and Cersei get into the dungeons underneath the keep, I guess. But their escape is completely blocked by rubble in every direction. Cersei finally realizes she's completely fucked, and she begs anyone and everyone not to let her baby die. And then the entire keep falls in on their heads as Jamie tries to comfort her, calm her down.
People said is like, this is too good for Cersei. This wasn't like, but the thing is like, this is where I want to defend Thrones a little bit, because Thrones has always been about what is realistic. And all too often, people that commit atrocities, I mean, what can you do? What can you do to a person that's been responsible for the death of a million people that's worth it?
There's no justice there, no.
Yeah, there's like not even what you could devise in a million lifetimes in the blackest cell of the dungeons of King's Landing could really bring justice to Cersei, reducing her to this pathetic, mewling character that's begging Jaime to save her because she can't save herself and she's fucked all this up and she's ignored all this. Like, it's, to me, as fit. And even this moment that, like, Jaime comforting her because, like, what's the point of not, like, there's a couple ways they could have done, as we've already discussed, where I'd have been on board with this. This isn't the worst sin the episode committed.
No.
And, like, just in isolation, setting aside all the theories about the Valonqar stuff and the things that we've talked about, and even the way that weirdly, the show has foreshadowed that. Like, I remember last season, a lot of people's eyebrows raised when they introduced that map throne. And, you know, one is like, if you've avoided a spoiler podcast, you probably don't know what the Valonqar theory is. But there is a prophecy as part of that thing that that the Wood Witch told Cersei, where she said, you know, you'll have three kids and they'll all have golden hair and they'll have golden shrouds. And then the queen that's more beautiful, you'll replace her. The final stanza to that was, then the Valonqar, which is of High Valyrian for little brother, will come and wrap his fingers around your pale throat and choke the life from you. And last season, they had the map painted up, and Cersei was standing on the neck of Westeros, and Jaime was standing on the fingers, the part of the Westeros that the little finger's from, called the fingers. And people are like, aha, done deal. He's the little brother that's going to do it. And they don't have to pay off the Valonqar stuff. It's just odd to me that they didn't. It's odd to me that they had all that kind of foreshadowing of the show itself.
Yeah.
And then they just zigged. It's not the worst thing. It's just, this is fine. I think it's horseshit the way Jaime got here. And it seems like there was better ways to go. But it seemed like a lot of the things that a lot of decisions came down to, they just wanted to subvert everything.
Yeah, I agree.
And that might be a problem that Martin has, too. Like, a satisfying character arcs, eventually you have to stop subverting. Because if you keep subverting, then just nothing makes sense. Everything's arbitrary and random.
Yeah.
And
I'm inclined to say, in this moment,
yeah.
You know, this idea of the Valonqar theory coming true with the fucking keep coming down all around him, mm-hmm. and dragon fire from every direction and the Mad Queen... None of that matters anymore in that moment, right?
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
like how it led up to it.
Mm-hmm.
I hate basically everything about what they did to Jaime's character. But in that moment, like, well, he's going to stick a knife in Cersei's back.
No, I get it.
And fulfill some kind of prophecy that wasn't even in the show.
Like,
so, yeah.
In
like,
isolation, this makes, is a great end for them both.
Well, I think in the moment, I think, you know, you have to almost isolate this scene from the rest of the episode.
Yes,
which
indeed.
Completely undermines that character. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in this scene, there's no point in him killing Cersei anymore.
Right.
And... you know, whatever residual love is still there after she betrays him and he leaves her and goes to fight for the living and comes back, whatever's left shows through. And I think that's fine in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So then, I do like the Jaime, you know, another prophecy, not quite as clear of a prophecy, more of just like a thing Jaime said, but it comes true. He liked to die in the arms of the woman he loves.
Mm-hmm.
That happens. That's a pretty nice moment. And then we go to Arya waking up from her trauma yet again and stumbles out into the street, where she comes face to face with a white horse and she rides it straight out of the episode.
People said this is like the death riding a pale horse. That makes no sense to me.
No.
Arya is not the personification of death in this scene.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people saying she was.
I mean, just like symbol of like death, like literally people dying because she looks like a dead person. Because, like, when I think of pale horse and the rider's death, I think of something that's dangerous and deadly, and I don't think of...
I think of Danny.
I don't think of a person that's a victim.
No.
And Arya was essentially victimized this entire episode.
So I agree with you.
I think it's more...
I've seen people saying she's off to actually kill Danny now, and that's, like,
She's definitely at the top of the list of people you'd suspect of killing Danny, for sure.
Right, and that's why they're proclaiming her as Death.
But isn't that weird? Well, okay, but isn't that weird because it's also kind of like completely undoes the character progress she had this episode, though. Like, she's going to go back to pursue vengeance?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of, you know, lessens the Hound's speech to her. But also, there's this white horse that this child is carrying around this whole episode, and you can see it burnt to a crisp at the end. They show a close-up of it. So what does that say about this horse?
I was thinking that, like, to me, that tells me that this is Arya's chance to reclaim, if not her innocence, like, some life beyond just her vengeance. I thought that the symbolism for it was just, like, you know, white is a very pure, a righteous color. It's a peaceful color, and that she has chosen a life that she can lead and has some kind of actual life to it beyond death versus just pursuing vengeance unto her own death.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's fine. And like I said, this is like, if you're looking for the foreshadowing, like, here's the people, like, look at the ash falling just like snow, just like we saw in Dany's vision of the Undying, and you know, we saw the dragon shadow just like in Bran's dream and vision. And yes, they did check off all those boxes. But I hope if you've made it this far, and you probably haven't, if you're the people that hated our take, I hope at least we've explained why it didn't work for us. And we've used real reasons, and we've talked about it from a thematic and a filmmaking perspective, and from a plot and from a character development. And you can disagree with us, but please, please, please don't say this is just because we are disappointed and it didn't end the way we wanted to, because...
Yeah.
Gosh, I've wasted an hour and 49 minutes of all of our time, if that's the takeaway on that. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car?
Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
If you're like most people, you have in your home just a single, solitary router desperately trying to pump out bits for your entire house. Unfortunately, this model just doesn't work for our high-bandwidth world. Wi-Fi dead spots and weak signals can cause terrible performance in your favorite games and stuttering and buffering while watching your favorite shows. IT pros have solved this problem for years by deploying a distributed system of multiple overlapping access points at considerable effort and expense. But now with Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home faster than Daenerys turns to the dark side. Simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it'll walk you through each step of the process. It's quick, easy, and painless, unlike the average death on Game of Thrones. With the Eero system, you get Eero Plus, which is a suite of powerful and automated security tools that offer you total network protection. You can block malicious content across your entire site. It checks the sites you visit against a database of millions of known threats, keeping you and your family from accidentally visiting a malicious site. It also automatically tags content that is violent, illegal, or adult, giving you control over what your family can access right from the Eero app. It also gets rid of annoying and intrusive ads. They've also partnered with third parties to offer sophisticated VPN services, password management, and antivirus protection. Best of all, Eero updates itself automatically, so you're constantly protected from the latest internet threats. Eero provided me with an Eero base and beacon pair unit to test in my home. My home is nearly 100 years old and has lots of rooms separated by thick plaster and masonry, and has been notoriously difficult to get signal throughout the house. I went from unboxing to a fully functional mesh network in less than 20 minutes. I was very impressed with their app that gave specific guidance for placement of the devices and was even able to run a series of self-tests to check the setup and give advice to improve my coverage and speeds. If you want full coverage, high-speed, ultra-secure Wi-Fi network that you never have to think about again, it's easy. Eero is offering our listeners $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons package with 1 year of Eero Plus. Just visit Eero.com/GOT and at checkout enter GOT. Once again, that's Eero, Eero.com/GOT and enter GOT at checkout. Here's the scenario for you. It's late on Sunday. You've watched the final episode of Game of Thrones and you've got to need to talk about it with your friends. But how many of you have a ready-made set of buddies that are as knowledgeable and passionate about Thrones as you?
That's where we come in. After the final episode airs this Sunday, we'll take to the microphones to discuss the end, which becomes our instant take. But did you know, we also record an extended version live, which features a discussion of the episode with the Bald Move community. The catch is, you have to be a club member to watch, listen, and participate.
But it's easy to sign up. Just go to club.baldmove.com, where you can see all the premium features club memberships grants. And you can start a free 30-day trial. Join in on the After Thrones conversation at club.baldmove.com. Okay, let's go to feedback. What do you think about that, Jim?
I think I talked over you.
Okay, let's get to feedback. We still have we dealt with a lot of feedback in the episode. Also, you know, we got 900 plus pieces of feedback, but like these big episodes, typically they kind of cluster. There's definitely a curve where people. Although it is funny how. When you have this division, like all the emails take on a strident tone of like, I've got the one valid take of this episode and everyone else is wrong. And there's a lot of people like, you know, with subject lines, you must read this on the air. Like, okay, all right.
Don't tell me what I must.
Yeah. I like that just about as much as the people to say, edit this email to be read on the air as you wish. I'm like, oh, I get the editorial.
The 16 paragraph.
Yeah. I get editorial decision on the podcast. That's cool. I'm glad. All right. Josh L. Again, send feedback to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Josh L., I love the idea of fan bankruptcy, all 11 chapters of it. But now that we've moved further into our fandom destitution, I have some name suggestions, which we asked for on the spoiler edition. Fan foreclosure, devotee default, down and out devotees, audience insolvency, or show skint, which is, I've never heard the word skint before.
I think it's racist.
It probably is.
No, I have no idea. I kind of like the idea of insolvency because that says more than just bankruptcy, right? That's like
Yeah.
This is the end of the line.
Yeah. I like fan foreclosure, too.
Foreclosure, it's like, yeah. Bankruptcy, you're taking away their fandom.
Bankruptcy, you get to keep your house.
Uh-huh.
Foreclosing, it's like, nah, you get nothing. You're going to have to go sleep on your dad's couch now.
That's good. It also has the alliteration angle, not the illiteracy. I'm illiterate, apparently.
Yeah. No, I like the idea that you're now sleeping on your dad's couch, and he's very disappointed in you.
Oh, yeah.
He told you this was going to happen. You invest 8 seasons into Game of Thrones, or you're gonna get your fan foreclosed on, and you didn't listen, and now you got to put up with his bullshit. Moving on to Peter G. After the Long Night episode, I became concerned about how fan bankruptcy was affecting your show. This is most evident after last week's Last Stark, where the instant cast was pretty positive. However, the main podcast spends most of its time being critical.
What? I thought I was mostly positive on that episode. Okay.
Yeah, but I was so. Here's the true tea. I wanted to give the show the benefit of the doubt on that Last Stark thing because, you know, I actually try to be aware of my biases as much as possible. And anytime that the show's zigging where I'm expecting the zagging, I try to account for that. So, especially on the instant take, I don't want to come out guns blazing and look like a dumbass. So I try to be a little bit more measured. This episode. I talked about this in the instant podcast, but for the first 45 minutes, you and I both, I think, were like rationalizing every single thing we're watching. But then we got to Danny, and then we got to Euron. We're like, no fucking way, man.
Yeah,
no fucking way. So guilty as charged, I guess. I found many things about this episode problematic, but it seemed to me like Euron was so upset that much of his analysis seemed flippant and checked out. Again, guilty as charged.
Yeah, I mean, we were angry in that moment, certainly.
I raged quit. During the Red Wedding when I was reading it, like it took me a while to come back and be like, okay, I got to reinvest myself in the story because there's still a lot of it left. It's obviously harder to do that on the last chapter than midway through the saga, but that's what I'm trying to battle with. I was relieved listening to the spoiler podcast as Aaron very articulately reflected on how close you can be to the material, how it's hard to be a fan and have a business reliant on that fandom and still keep your perspective. I enjoyed this podcast and its larger perspective. But now we've got the Mad Queen and the Bells.
Does anybody find it ironic that, because I saw several people calling us out like on our business angle on this, and I'm like,
what do you mean calling us out?
We just said this whole thing is bullshit. Is that what a smart business owner does about the product? Like,
it's short term the best bet, and this is the shortest of terms. The season, it's short term best bet to always love the thing,
right?
Because
right.
fans are looking to be talked into it. Long term,
I'm giving you my honest opinion on this stuff.
Long term, it's not their smart play because people like, you know, once the spell's broken, then they don't trust you because here's the thing about Bold Move, and we've been doing this for 8+ years, going on 10 next year.
I don't know how that's possible, but yes,
we don't calculate, we don't triangulate, we don't think of what's like, as when it comes to our takes, we don't think about what's best for business, because what's best for business is always to bullshit and blow sunshine up asses and preserve,
well,
you know,
like you said, short term, yes,
yeah,
but long term, what's best for business is honesty,
yes,
trust in your audience,
especially our business where we rely on the generosity and support of our fans that see value in telling it like it is, because
yeah,
you know,
I mean, I cannot stress enough, go back and listen to all of like our Walking Dead stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were some of the first people to turn on this show.
Yeah.
And look where that thing went.
Yeah.
It went off the fucking rails. And every week you've got Chris Hardwick, who is the epitome of short-term business decision, apparently,
right,
spouting off about how great it is and how amazing the decisions are. And everybody else is looking at it going, what show are you watching?
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing is like Game of Thrones got to the end before, in my opinion, the wheels fell off.
Yes,
so
I agree.
You know, but still, before Danny broke the wheels, it wasn't fall off. She just broke them all.
Oh no.
All right. We keep on interrupting Peter here. He's trying to build to a point. I agree with you.
I take umbrage at agreeing with me.
Because I think the episode has some real problems for sure. However, I don't think it's the worst episode ever. They should have done a much better job. The overall reaction feels, though, like the Red Wedding, which we've discussed already. We're upset. Nothing seems rational. Our theories have been disproved. Opportunities for fan service have been lost. My guess is with Dany now leaving Westeros, when she learns that Varys, Tyrion, Sansa all know Jon's lineage, that was her final straw. She has no one except Grey Worm to trust, and as she said, she's unloved in Westeros. I think she decided to hell with Westeros, burn them all, and let them always remember and fear the dragons in the east. It'd be ironic if John ends up having to break his oath and kill Danny, something Jamie did and never lived down.
And yet the double D's say not premeditated.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, there a lot of this stuff where you lose Barrist and Selmy, you lose Jorah, you lose Missandei, like all of her true blue there from the beginning fellows have gone by the wayside, and now all she has left are these foreigners that she can't fully trust. Like, again, they really did, in retrospect, a fine job. Like, I really wonder if this had 7 episodes or 8 episodes, like if they couldn't have... Clearly, they squared the circle for... at least some people. I think if they had another beat or two or took the time to really sweat out how they could make Danny turn and still, I just wish they'd done a better job. And again, it is like, you know, Peter, it's like, as you're saying, they should have done a better job for sure. Yeah. This is like the most expensive, most lavishly funded, most everything. Like HBO would give them everything they wanted.
Yeah.
They just didn't come up with anything better, and it's a shame. Moving on to Ryan. I was certainly angry after Long Night episode. I just couldn't get over how stupid the battle tactics and decisions of this protagonist were. But on a scale perspective, I thought Danny's decision to burn King's Landing was meagerly justified. Every other section of the realm had been burned by this war for succession. Why not the Lannister armies and the citizens of the capital, too? Point of fact, the Lannister armies got fucking torched last season. Certainly they had it coming their way as much as anyone. It's a terrible waste and tragedy, but Danny decided to establish clear dominance over Westeros with fear to make the world fear what she has felt. Yeah, I mean, they almost rounded home. They got called out. They got thrown out. They didn't get to home base.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the problem is that's a big deal. You get across home base, you score, you get tagged out at the plate, you don't win. It's a very binary thing. You don't get credit for, like, oh, gee, they got 99.99 of the way to home base. Like, that guy tagged them out by an inch. Do I get 75% of a run? No, you get a lot of this stuff works out. You just don't know. If you don't get it 100% of the way there, you don't get credit for any of it. He moves on to Jamie and Cersei. The beautifully romantic ending for Cersei and Jamie that no one asked for. Of course, but it was fitting for them. Having had it, I wouldn't wish it for any other way. You ask for empathy for the townsfolk of King Landing, but why not for Cersei and Jaime? Aren't they still human? Terrible as they are?
No.
Their death was a profoundly human moment and a testament to their epic love for one another in this twisted and perverse world that has denied them their love for better or worse.
No, I was not rooting for Walter White in the end of Breaking Bad. I am absolutely not sympathetic in any way towards Cersei.
No, I agree.
I'm sorry.
Like evil, like, you know, maybe Hitler cried as he poisoned his dog and blew Eva Brain's out. But you know what? Tough luck, partner.
Yeah.
I only wish there was a fucking hell that you could burn in. So... I recognize that this is a very Game of Thrones to humanize them and show them, like, to show that moment, but okay, that's the other problem that I think that George has ahead of him too, if he ever finishes these books, is maybe you do subvert to the end, but then is it cool to leave your fans dejected and unsatisfied? Like, I guess
that's the kind of thing I think can only be judged in retrospect.
All right.
Over the course of time, I think you need some distance from it. You need to say, okay, what is the story he's trying to tell here? Was it successful or not? And you can sort of get away from how you feel about the thing and more just like, how did it work? Overall, the trouble here is I don't think I think in the instant take, George has a huge opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
He's seen the reaction to what are presumably the outlined bulleted points of how this thing is going to end. He's seen a poor execution leading up to it. He has the opportunity to be the fucking hero of the day.
Yeah, because...
Come out with these books, tell this story right, and I am on board with Danny torching this city. I am on board with Danny becoming the evil mad queen.
Yeah, this is something I was going to save for the spoiler edition because it's more books, but like I'm actually a little bit more bullish on the books because I do think that a lot of this is right off of George's bullet points. Like Danny turning mad queen and this... the Stark men becoming the rapists and pillagers. Like this is so fucking Martin... And just what you see, just with a few small tweaks, that this could be so much better.
Mm-hmm.
But his challenge is going to be just getting on with it because the Double D's started narrowing this world four seasons ago. Martin's still expanding it as of Dance of Dragons. So, like, he's got to somehow turn that corner and tell this fucking story and hit those beats better, but without continuing to garden up even more and even more. And that's the thing. But, like, yeah, if he was kind of, like, wincing and seeing how people would react to this story, I think it's very encouraging because, like, no one's saying it's total bullshit. Like, I wonder the people that have gotten, like, Khaleesi tattoos and named their daughters Khaleesi, like, how this feels, like...
Martin's in a really tough position here because he can't say, whoa, maybe hold off on the Khaleesi tattoos and children until you see the whole thing, people.
Sure.
He can't do that, right?
Sure.
So...
But like, other than those people that have gone that
crazy,
like,
them.
I don't think there's many people saying just outright, there's no way Danny falls to the dark side. So to me, that's the thing I'm most afraid of. And if I'm getting, like, thumbs up on that, I just need to finesse it. To me, if this doesn't get him off the pot and finishing Winds of Winter, I don't know what the fuck will. Nothing. If we don't get Winds of Winter within a year, I don't think we'll ever get it.
Yeah.
All right, Sean has a question. Is the Iron Throne gone? I feel like it's the one constant in the series. It symbolizes quite a bit in the story and even the advertising of the show. It was in the Red Keep, so I'd have to say it's crushed and ruined, but I'm sure the writers will just make it appear next week, unblemished. Will Dany want a new throne? I don't know how much the Red Keep got destroyed.
I mean, the whole thing crumbles in on Jaime and Cersei, right? From the foundation up. I can't imagine it's still standing, but they kind of need it to...
I think certain parts of it, probably got crushed, but like, because there's like all these weird like standalone towers that are attached to it, and
which she blasted a couple of those too. So,
and the other thing is like, if they can't tell the story of someone getting stabbed in the guts and dying right, then like I fully believe the Red Keep will be 90% undamaged next. I mean,
yeah,
they told the story of the Dothraki getting annihilated, not decimated, not dimimated, not. just annihilated, and yet there was as many Dothraki charging as there ever was in the Long Night. So the show just does that. So right. Red Keep, the Iron Throne dying off screen, no fucking way. I'm gonna say that. Doug L, maybe it's the lawyer in me, but I spent some time today pondering the events of last night's episode and trying to square the circle that is the Dany smash scene. I agree that if it's Dany's turn is the product of her madness taking hold, the show didn't really justify it because it never clearly articulated what that last straw that broke the dragon's back was. But perhaps what we saw was not Dany's psyche crumbling, but rather a strategic choice. She finds herself essentially where Renly Baratheon was, desiring the throne but with no legitimate basis to knock the rightful heir out of the way. Renly was, until his death, relying on his relative popularity over Stannis to carry the day with the small folk. Dany correctly susses out that she has only fear, not love at her disposal. Had she accepted King's Landing surrender, she would have won the war, but eventually lost a piece to Jon once his lineage became common knowledge. And that, thanks to Sansa, is inevitable. Since Dany's only path to the throne goes through the popular and rightful heir, Jon, she knows the only way to ensure she remains in power after Jon is, at best, sidelined and at worst killed is to deter all challengers with an overwhelming show of force.
I might buy that without the surrender.
And also, does she have to make this calculation in 30 fucking seconds?
Well, like, the surrender to me says you have time to try and figure this out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, take a moment. Try and sit down with Jon after this is all over, after the immediate threat is dealt with, and figure out if there's a way around his lineage. Because Jon clearly does not want this. The one thing I believe is true in Game of Thrones is that Jon will never be king.
Yeah.
So,
although, now I think that's like...
I think it's more likely Sansa will be queen. I think Sansa sitting on that throne makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because Jon doesn't want it. Jon,
she has zero claim, period. Like, wouldn't you have the same problem that Jon... Like, if Jon can't get out of this no matter what, then how is he going to get out of it?
If he abdicates the throne and just says, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do it, then who's left? Gendry comes swooping in, I guess.
That's what I say. Like, now it's like almost like Gendry is in the hot seat. And the other thing is
like you have to believe that Jon is not... being honest here.
Or maybe this is why I was also trying to keep the democracy theory alive, because there's like, honestly, with only 1 hour left, it feels like there's no way they're going to have like that. We're not ready for a denouement where we see like how Westeros might continue on.
Got to get to that.
Because now I'm like trying to figure out, I guess someone's going to sit the Iron Throne. It's going to be like Tyrion or Jon or Sansa or something or fucking Bronn. Or no, not Bron, Bran.
I mean, it won't be John. John has said time and time again, and he's an honorable and truthful man to his fucking core.
Yeah, but they're also saying that the best king is the one that doesn't want it.
But it doesn't matter. John's not going to take it. John,
you don't see John like at the end of this. Like I see John like on the end at the
no, because
the
he's
throne.
King of the North because he had to be. He absolutely had to be to save all of humanity. Where is the threat now? Where is the threat that's going to push him to this kingdom?
That if somebody else takes the throne besides him, it's going to plunge the realm into more war. Like I think that like I see him sitting on the throne
but
the way
who?
Like old ass Conan sits on the throne at the end of Conan the Barbarian. Like he's
who's left who fits that description though. It's not Gendry. It's not Sansa.
Why?
It's not Arya. None of these people are evil. None of these people have this inherent trait.
Danny
wasn't
evil until this episode. Like what? Like,
none of these
like
people have shown even an inkling of what Danny showed.
An up-jump bastard from Fleabottom gonna have sunshine blown up his ass by some highborn lord.
Everybody who has had a track record of having any potential to do that stuff is already dead. There's nobody in the kingdom left to be evil. They'd have to be evil over the course of years. They'd have to turn evil, and we don't have time to tell that story. John's not going to sit on the throne. John doesn't have the pressure that he had when he became the king of the North.
Having a lot of faith that the Double D's aren't going to just have
well,
John come in and say,
yeah, that's fair. I can't say what butchery they're going to do to his character next
episode.
I
sit the gun, huh? You know, it's like he'll just start barking like a dog and
fair. And then they'll say, oh yeah, John was actually always wanted to be king and behind the thrones realm. Season
Ghost
8, episode 6.
Ghost will have
six.
Come back in the off show, and he'll be sitting on the Iron Throne the way Jaime Lannister was when Ned Stark comes in, and that'll be, John will see it as a sign.
Yeah.
Like, in the first episode, you were the sign that I was a Stark, and now you're conferred, thank you, and then they lick each other's face, and yeah, I said each other's. It's going to get weird. It's going to get weird. You wanted to see
a proper goodbye to John? You say weird.
Yeah.
You say weird.
Yeah. People say a lot
of things.
I say
Tuesday.
All right, Jenny C. Never emailed you guys before, but after listening to your instant take on the Bells, I was disappointed to hear how roundly negative your reactions were. Sorry about that. Just being honest.
What can I do?
I tend to agree with many of the criticisms regarding staging, plot holes, jetpacking, etc., but I do find I'm able to separate the show from the books and accept it as a very simplified version of Martin's vision. I can't help but feel like I watched the worst-case scenario play out before my eyes. I found it devastating, but it was so Game of Thrones. It felt like watching Ned Stark being executed, the Red Wedding, and so much more. I witnessed the most absolute devastation possible from just one Targaryen and her dragon. The last thing I wanted to see was for Dany to become the villain, but I feel like it made sense. She was driven to the brink by the death of Rhaegal and the execution of Missandei, but the final nail in the coffin was Jon's rejection. Her love for Jon was her Achilles' heel. When she had won the battle and the bells were ringing, I saw a broken woman. Winning was no longer enough. Her decision in that moment came from a very dark place and showed that, like Jon said, if you use those dragons to melt castles and burn cities, you're no different. Ultimately, she is just as bad as Cersei. I don't know, this feels like something George Martin would write. I agree with you, Jenny, to this point. Like, there is nothing that except for the nail of the coffin being John's rejection, because there's literally like 2 days between that and there was the scene where Tyrion begged for the mercy for King's Landing, which was granted, and then she wins. And I would like to hear, for the spoiler edition, someone to clearly articulate a through point for that does not that does not rely on a headcanon of how you that explains all those events. Like I don't
she,
know.
She would have never given that nod if she were not willing to spare these people.
Right.
And that says to me that it was not premeditated. It was all in that moment, and nothing pushed her in that moment.
Right.
She had the victory in her grasp.
Right.
And she simply decided not to accept it.
And I just don't think it's in her character to,
no,
like, you know what? These King's Landing fucks got off easy. Maybe she does that to Cersei. Maybe mm-hmm. she does that to the entire Red Keep. I'll grant that. And I think that, and that's the thing. I don't understand why that's not enough.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
It's
and
horrifying.
You know, the other thing
it's
is like,
it's a terrible thing to do.
What? Because it's even more poignant. Because, like, what if she does that to the Red Keep and it still incites Grey Worm? Like, she wasn't going to burn the civilians, but her own people misinterpret her actions. So then you've got the exact same end game. It just works better.
And you can go as far as you want with that. Cersei could have already escaped the Red Keep. It could have been all for naught, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's destroyed these innocent people and gotten no closer to her goal. Like,
right. But her just being like, just being psychopathic, it's not satisfying to me. Anyway, she continues. My biggest disappointment was Jaime's return to Cersei, but I did hope to see more. Or I did hope to see a more redemption arc. You know what? I think we're done. I don't think we need to. We've talked enough about. If she's just going to agree with us on Cersei and Jaime, let's strike it from the record. Okay. Thank you for that, Jenny. Let's move on to Tarek J. Dany's story has always been one of how far she will take her vengeance and those who have tempered her along the way. At times she went mad, but it was masked by her need for retribution as an audience. I don't know that I agree with that. I would like to be given an example of the time she went mad, and the only reason we excuse it is because we agreed with her vengeance. Like, that's like, she's either justified or she's not, you know? Yes, Viserys was an asshole, but she had him executed simply for being an ass and never felt bad about it. Did she?
No. There were many reasons to have him executed.
Yeah.
The least of which is selling her off into sexual slavery.
And I think that at the reason she got, she begged for him to be spared until he kicked the door in the Khal Drogo's house, directly threatened her and her unborn child, and demanded he be taken across the narrow sea right then and there. Like, that's not being just an asshole, okay? Like, that's committing treason against the
cow. Being an asshole is cutting
cow.
Somebody off in traffic and then giving them the finger.
Right. It was same for the true of the Masters of Karth, Yunkai, the Khals, and Meereen. I just don't agree. All those were very bad people, like Nazi-level bad people. Oh, so she could meekly submit to living in a big tent with all the other crones and being raped to death? Or she can walk outside and Dracar. Like, that's not an immoral choice she made. She slaughtered them not necessarily because they're bad people, but because they didn't respect and love her in the way she thought they should.
I think there's a tinge of that in some of the things that Dany does.
For sure.
I will agree that there is a tinge of that,
because,
but
again,
I don't think it's all that.
It didn't come from nowhere, for sure. Part of the subversion that A Song of Ice and Fire has given us was telling a fantasy story is that the heroes are flawed, conquerors are fucked up individuals that are not strong enough, or that are strong enough to keep challengers at bay. With all the people that have tempered Dany in the past, with Jorah, Selmy Barristan, and Missandei now dead, no one could sway from her worst impulses. Is it any surprise things ended up the way they did? Again,
except Tyrion, who I thought did sway her from her worst impulse one last time, and then she managed to succeed. So.
And no, it's not surprising they ended up. It's just there was one more beat I was waiting for.
Yes. And it could have been glorious.
Right. But that's an important beat. That's the difference between me. It's different than Han Solo shooting first and shooting second.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
That's it.
Such a good comparison.
If Jim pulls a gun out right now and points it at me and I have a gun, I shoot him back. I didn't murder him. I defended my life. And it's just as moral of a choice as letting him kill me. You know? Like, Thomas C. Dany stated multiple times. So Thomas is going to try to lay out a argument for Dany being a mad queen. Dany stated many times she's destined to rule. Agreed. She sees her victory as a foregone conclusion. Agreed. The steadfast belief in victory causes her to see all of her setbacks as caused by her enemies. Agreed. She sees the devotion the freed slaves have to those that freed them as devotion to her because of her destiny and moral superiority. I agree with that. This causes her to see the distrust of the Northerners as treason. Yep. This causes her to see the failure of the people of King's Landing to take the city for her like the slaves did at Meereen as treason. Okay, this is where I'm starting to... What?
Wait, what failure?
The failure of the people at King's Landing to take the city for her.
Wait, what failure?
The failure of people...
Wait, what failure? am I wrong? The bells were ringing. The people of King's Landing did take the city for her.
Yeah, and here's the other thing is, you're acting like the people of Meereen, like some of these things, like... Dany had built up a history of freeing these people, like... First, she tricked the masters of Astapor and burnt them with her dragons and stole the armies. Then she broke in secret and killed all the, like, security and flung open the gates, and the people did the... Like, she didn't just camp outside the fucking walls and say, free yourselves! Like, there was help and assistance and an understanding that she was there to save them, not, oh, Jesus Christ, this woman's got giant dragons, she's going to kill us all. All right.
You have to show that the enslavers are vulnerable before the slaves can rise up against them.
So we're already butting heads here, Thomas. Let's see how we go here. John cannot have a claim because she is destined to rule, so the claim is a lie. I don't think that's in the text that Dany thinks that this is bullshit. I think that's her first reaction, but like, I think that she believes that John is telling the truth. Do you think that Dany thinks this is a lie?
No, no, no. I mean, okay. If she did think it was a lie, she would have no problem with this secret getting out.
So here's where I think the headcanon is starting to spin out of control, in my opinion, Thomas. She thinks that John is being tricked by Sansa, Bran, and Sam. She's already declared the Tarleys as her enemy. She will never believe his word.
But she does believe the word.
When she
wouldn't care about this secret that isn't true.
Like, when she found out that Sam was a Tarly, she felt guilt. She kind of felt guilty and embarrassed. Like, again, her first reaction was like, oh, that's bullshit. Oh, he would say that. I don't know. Like, some of this stuff feels like...
No, I think they played that beat where she's like, can you really trust, your best friend
and
your brother?
Your best friend, yeah.
But then everything after that, this is the show not tell part of it. Everything that she does after that says she believes this claim is real and she's got to fight back against it. And if it gets out to the people of the kingdom, they will support John instead of her because he has a better claim. That's all of that is on the screen.
John knows that it's true, so he does not support her in keeping a secret. She believes this is so obvious a lie that the only reason John could have to spread this is treason. I think you're right in that she sees John spreading it as treason, but it's not because it's a lie. It's because she saw it as an inevitable outcome to his action, and he couldn't lie to his family.
Yes.
So it's a slight difference there, but I think it's going to be a huge difference in where you build up to your idea here. Varys conspires to crown Jon due to his claim, a claim she believes is a lie. He gets Dracarys, okay. She seriously suspects Tyrion as a traitor now, especially after he told Varys the lie about Jon's claim. Yep. She gives him one more chance and listens to his begging to call off the attack if she hears the bells of the city. Later, Tyrion frees Jaime. She's already declared Jaime a traitor. Jaime is freed at night, and the battle happens in the morning. She knows Tyrion freed his brother. Now she sees Tyrion as a traitor, too.
Why would she know that?
Yeah,
that's
not
on the screen anywhere. That's headcanon, man.
This is an assumption that you're making, and we don't know how late at night that Tyrion visited all this. Like, this is all in your head. This is not on the screen. So when she hears the bells, a part of a plan from someone she now sees as a traitor, she feels justified ignoring the plan. A seeming lack of resistance of the people of King's Landing to stop Cersei tells her that they support Cersei and they stop seeing the population of King's Landing as innocents. They're her enemy now. So,
nah.
And he concludes, sorry, this is well supported by the series. I think I just showed three or four instances where you are making perhaps logical inferences, but things that are not in the script, they're not on the screen, they're things that you are injecting to make this headcanon work, which is fine. If I'm fine with putting headcanon in there to like explain things that are working, but it's just not working for me, so I'm not extending them that benefit. Moving on, Sean D, regarding Jon Snow, what's the point of having an annoying paladin character if he's just going to make his self-righteous opinion heard all the time, except when we actually need to hear it? Did he say more than two lines in this episode? And his best throaty Jon Snow bro, we got a, she is my queen, and don't rape that girl. Even if it was ultimately turned down by Dany, a real protest from Jon reminding her about her true goals would have moved the emotional needle for me. Yeah, honestly, I would love to have heard Jon and Dany themselves talking about the fact that she's his aunt. Because it seems like that's the thing that's broken down their relationship. And for them
all he can do is just say, you're my queen, you're my queen, you're my queen.
To have an honest conversation about how this has changed and how, like, just to talk this through, like, something, man. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
Jesus, how many Skyler, Walter White back and forth did we see in the nature of their relationship changed over... Is it asking too much to have one of those conversations about how this not affects her political chances, but how it affects how John feels her and how she feels about John? Okay. Connor, was I alone in getting serious Highlander vibes in the bowl that was promised? Visually with the Hound and the Mountain battling out on the spire at the broken outer wall, Dany swooping in on Drogon in the background, giving the sky visible from the spire this ethereal glow of oranges and purples, reminded so much of the Kurgan battle in Highlander. When
the
Sean
one
Connery
on the
bites
rooftop?
The dust. Huh?
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah. Did you pick up on any of this? I mean, mm-mm. I wasn't thinking Highlander, but sure, why not?
Yeah.
Nola P. I wrote in last week complaining that that Jamie had fucked and chucked Brienne, which felt totally out of character. You thoughtfully said to wait and see what happened this episode because Jamie may be going to kill Cersei.
Whoops.
Yeah. Now that we know that he genuinely left the North to return to Cersei's side, how do you judge a storyline with Brienne? We haven't talked about this aspect of it.
The biggest victim here.
I think it's completely pointless. Jamie's relationship with Brienne was among the show's most beautiful and subtle for years, and suddenly the writers took a sledgehammer to it. They had Jamie treat Brienne like dirt, taking her virginity, then ditching her the next day. Then made it clear in this episode that he's all about Cersei and Cersei alone. Yeah, dude, or lady, Jamie goes and kills Cersei, and he dies, and it gets back to Brienne. Like, that doesn't devastate her, because I think she puts two and two together and figures it out. Here, she's just going to hurt the man that she loved, the man that took her virginity, the man that knighted her, the man that she had turned from thinking he's a monster and a kingslayer and an oathbreaker to this paragon of virtue, and it's so... No, he's just a shitter. You were knighted by one of the worst fucking... You were knighted by a drug addict whose drug of choice was fucking Cersei Lannister.
Yeah. No, it's... I mean, it does injustice to Brienne as an intelligent woman. It does injustice to Jamie as...
I don't think it does. It doesn't hurt Brienne's character because she's blameless. She had no way to predict that this was going to happen.
Yeah. That's fair. But it just fucks everything about that relationship that I thought was beautiful. And,
yeah. It's a real bummer.
And exciting for Brienne as a character. And what it does to Jaime is potentially even worse. And
I'm like Cersei below the Red Keep. Like, I always wanted to be a Brienne-Jaime shipper, but not like this. Not like this. Please, Jaime, don't let this relationship die like this. Yeah. Save it. Save it, Jaime. He's not gonna. He got rubbled. Moving on. Final email. Ernest T. I know Aaron wrote a couple of books on the religions of Westeros, but do we have any material on the mythical creatures of Westeros? As I saw Drogon light up King's Landing, I couldn't help but wonder if he was going to ever run out of fuel. It seemed like he had an endless supply. I know this is very trivial considering what happened in this episode, but it bugged the crap out of me, especially on rewatch. Now I'm curious if dragon anatomy has been explored anywhere else in the fantasy literature. Just curious what your thoughts are. I mean, in this series, dragons are fire-made flesh, and they are... almost demigod kind of magical beings. And thus they're kind of exempt from the laws of thermodynamics. So it bothered me a little bit in gee whiz, this guy seems like he's got infinite info or ammo. Where is all this fire coming from? But it's magic. So
I think there's the chemical process is akin to like a fusion reactor where the amount of energy output is sort of on that scale with the mass that you input.
Yeah.
To where, and they have, these dragons have abnormally large abdomens. I assume it's all just sacks of chemicals combined. No,
they're full of hydrogen. They're full. That's how they fly too.
Right. So every time they shoot fire, they get a little bit heavier.
Yeah.
Or they get a little bit lower. It's harder to fly.
It's true. Right.
They lose all that hydrogen inside them.
But all that charred goat and Varys meat, they just break that down into hydrogen.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. They and oxygen. The human body and presumably goat bodies too are 3/4 water. That's nothing but hydrogen and oxygen. You put those together. That's a fuel and an accelerant. What we say in the fire starting business. So the dragon math checks out on this.
Yeah. They also have the added bonus of if you get enough dragons on the planet, you don't need plants anymore because they just process water into oxygen. And who needs that carbon dioxide stuff?
So we still have another podcast. I encourage everyone, because I tried to articulate her points. I tried to consider some I thought reasonable points from the people that are not seeing it our way. We can continue talking about that, because I would love to be talked into this making sense. We can also talk on Friday, what this means for the books, like what this means for George Martin. It'd be interesting if George has something to say. Because he hasn't really commented since the death of Shireen. And maybe that's like, you know, he made that statement of like, well, the books are going to be different from the series, and he doesn't have to revisit that. But it'd be interesting to see if he has says something in the days to come. I'd be interested to see if you guys have something to say, because that's the other thing we're talking about, you know, our business incentive. You know, I wrote books that probably had done a lot better had Game of Thrones be universally beloved in the end. They'd have a much fatter tale. But also, my writing partner, Anthony, like we both had like two fan theories that we kind of like you kind of wrote up, especially for the book. I did my Democracy in Westeros. He actually did something that surprised me, which was an argument for Dany turning into the Mad King Queen. So it's like it actually if they had told that story, like, god damn, that would have looked like a genius fucking prediction and really well argued and sourced, and not just from the tomes, but from like, you know, like the political and religious history that George is drawing from. It would have been just dandy if they had told the story correctly, or one that like, and it's not just me. That's the other thing. Like, if it was just me and Jim, and like 90% of people were like, oh, you guys are fucking stupid and you weren't watching the episode, I'd feel better about it. But
it's only like 40% of people telling me that online.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, I don't know if this is going to be a Sopranos or more of like a Lost or more of, I'm trying to think of one, like a Walking Dead, where more and more people like wake up to the idea that there was some problems here all along. I don't know, but that's,
yeah,
the
I mean,
stuff.
I want to see next episode. I want to see what they do. I'm prepared to come back and sort of judge this season quickly.
Yeah.
After the fact. And
yeah,
you know, I don't think they can do anything to salvage this episode.
No.
And potentially not even the entire end of Game of Thrones. I think they can give some characters some good moments from here on out.
Yeah. I really want to see the bittersweet. I've seen the bitter, and like if you have to go back to like early episode 4 to get any sweet, like, oh, well, you know what? Sam got Gilly pregnant. They're probably going to be happy.
Uh-huh. Ghost got to live out a happy life with Tormund
in
the North.
Ghost got to be his best boy, good boy pupper up with Tormund. Like, I don't know if that's what I consider, because this is so far just really dark and bitter. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about it on the spoiler edition on Friday, GameOfThrones@BaldMove.com, if you'd like to get that feedback in. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.